Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Past the hour, and it is the Halloween edition of Head On with Bob Kincaid. I am the Bob Kincaid in question, right? Yeah. So, being as how it's Halloween, I get to play with stuff. There I am. Yeah. I won't do this for very long. Because they'll probably screw things up along the way anyway. But anyway, happy Halloween, everyone. Out front of the house, Agnes and the kids are giving away candy. It's, you know, that, I mean, they're teenagers now. It's not exactly appropriate for them to be going door to door or anything. So I think Ferg's got his Optimus Prime mask on. And Agnes has some sort of strange wig. And me, I'm just sitting back here, my usual scary self. I'm terrifying without the costume. But a happy Halloween to you all. And we'll have a few kicks this evening. I've got a whole bunch of not read that often Edgar Allan Poe ready for various and sundry little moments. It's also Moran Monday on the horn. Yes, Marty, there are actually trick-or-treaters in my area. We do have children here. And it's they're precious and they're adorable. And let's see, what are we giving out this year? Yeah, caramels and Mary Janes. We're kind of retro old school. My father loved Mary Janes. They're kind of like Bit of Honeys, only a little, yeah, like sort of peanut butter taffy with real peanut butter in the middle or something approaching real peanut butter. I love them. They're yummy. So, I don't know, maybe, well, hopefully they'll have fun. But like I said, I've got some, Edgar Allan Poe ready to go. You know, everybody always reads The Raven. Once upon a midnight dreary while I pondered weak and weary. Oh, you can get into that sing-song rhythm in a real hurry. But there's other stuff as well. I mean, for heaven's sakes. Poe was a depressive and a drunk. And God knows what else. Stalker, maybe. Who knows? Did he know that he was, or was he just, did he know that he was writing stuff that would go down in the centuries as the epitome of horror? Or was he simply exercising his own demons? I mean, there's a lot of sadness and loneliness in what he writes as well. I mean, Annabelle Lee, for Christ's sakes. Yeah. It was 1829 when he wrote this. Thy soul shall find itself alone mid dark thoughts of the gray tombstone. Not one of all the crowd to pry into thine hour of secrecy. Be silent in that solitude which is not loneliness. For then the spirits of the dead who stood in life before thee are again in death around thee. And their will shall then overshadow thee. Be still. For the night, though clear, shall frown And the stars shall look not down from their high thrones in the heaven, with light like hope to mortals given, but their red orbs without beam to thy weariness shall seem as a burning and a fever which would cling to thee forever. Now our thoughts thou shalt not banish, now our visions near to vanish. From thy spirit shall they pass no more, like dewdrop from the grass. The breeze, the breath of God, is still, and the mist upon the hill, shadowy, shadowy, yet unbroken, is a symbol and a token, how it hangs upon the trees, a mystery of mysteries. That being a little ditty that he wrote called Spirits of the Dead. Charming, uplifting, sort of happy guy, that E.A. Poe. There's tons of stuff that he wrote. I mean, he was very, very productive. You know, The Raven has never been the same for me since that early Treehouse of Horror Simpsons episode in which Bart and Homer did The Raven. No one can touch that. But there's a, you know, there's a lot of that stuff, and we'll get back to more of it along the way. Now, just to get this stuff out of the way, I have to say this: I enjoyed the heck out of Football Sunday. Well, yeah, I mean it was the Steelers did a great job. That's who I got to watch. I really wanted to watch the Lions and the Tebows. I mean, how often do you get to watch a Christian get fed to the Lions anyway? And Tebow did not disappoint. I mean, he sucked for air. What a pleasure. What a joy. And you know, I was reminded, and maybe somebody should remind Tim, faith without works is dead. You can believe and you can Tebow in the end zone all you want to, but faith without works is dead. If you as a quarterback can't hit a receiver in stride in the NFL, you know, you're not gonna make it. And seeing those Lions players Tebowing at him after a sack, you know, he gives, oh my God, it was exquisite. He fumbled and it got returned for a touchdown. And he threw a 100-yard pick six interception. Yeah. The interception that he threw got returned 100 yards by a Lion for a touchdown. It was sweet. My favorite part, though, was after the game, you know, the obligatory press conference, when he said, well, we're just going to keep working harder and we're going to get better. Who's that we, Tim? You and that mouse in your pocket? Because it ain't the rest of the team. It's you, buddy. You're bad. And you're not going to get any better. I say you quit, you know, and this all happened to him because he was caught a smollicking all over some PR lady for the Focus on the Family or some such. Quit and go do missionary work, Tim. Yeah, it was funny. There was a whole parade of people wearing Tebow jerseys just leaving Mile High Stadium. Goodbye, Tim! Faith without works is dead. But, of course, the excuse-making has already begun. People blaming his wide receivers, people blaming his offensive line. No. It's you, Tim. Don't let them kid you. They're just trying to take it easy on you. It's you. But it was awfully fun to watch. Because, you know, it's not like I enjoy watching the mighty brought low. This is stuff that Tim Tebow brought upon himself. And this is really not about football. This is about the way the right wing advances itself. I mean, we were... those fundies from Colorado Springs... They were fit to burn down Mile High Stadium if John Fox, the coach there, didn't start Tim Tebow. When all along he told him he ain't ready. I've watched him for he ain't ready. But you know, right wingers and teabaggers and fundy freaks, they don't take no for an answer because Jesus likes them best. It's kind of a Halloween piece in its own right. Tim Tebow out there in Denver, all dressed up like an NFL quarterback, when it's clear that he probably couldn't. Well, I mean, he could quarterback the Florida Gators because there was a ton of NFL level talent around him, and an offense that was designed specifically for him. But it's already out there. You know, he's a winner. Good God, he just got his guts stomped out. How you calling that a winner? Oh, but he is. He's a winner. Yeah. Marty said, my Moran Monday nominee, John Fox, not that John Fox, the Broncos head coach, and the rest of the Denver Tebowphilia. I enjoyed that one, too. Has me looking forward to Oakland. The Raider Nation will not be so kind, I hope. Well, that remains to be seen, I suppose. You hope that it would be nice if the Raiders would come out and be the Raiders. But then again, tough call that. But that's what's next on the agenda. Nice crowd coming along in the chat room. Hey, Blue Ape, Jug of Punch, Lottie, Mark in Canada, Psychoticus Rex, Barky. Come on in if you've never tried it before. Head on RadioNetwork.com. Just click on chat room, register, get in. It's easy. And a little programming note. Remember, no show this Friday. I will be on the road to a meeting about the mountaintop removal. I mean, when I leave, it's generally about mountaintop removal. So Monday through Thursday, normal. Friday, gone. Okay, so Friday will be some sort of a rerun. Maybe we'll rerun this if it. Nah, we won't. It'll probably just be a rerun of Thursday. So that's our programming notes out of the way. Thanks to everybody, by the way, who responded to the rather desperate fundraising call that went out as of Friday. Here we are at the end of October, and we are about, we are about $1,050 away. Several of you did respond, and it is much appreciated. We're about $1,050 away from being able to not end October in the red. I would be kidding myself. I am a realist. I would be kidding myself if I said, hey, we'll have that by midnight. kind of doubt it. But still, any help that comes in between now and midnight does go toward October's fundraising efforts. And then we start sweating November. Just how it is. But thank you. Thank you to all of you. And I tried to write, and I think I did write individual thank you notes for every single individual who... I've been trying really hard to make sure that, because things just pile up, but never mind, that's no excuse. I've been trying to make sure that little email notes went out, and if I missed you, please let me know, and you have my apologies. But, so that's how we're looking at ending the month of October, November beginning, of course, tomorrow. And we sort of head down, you know, downhill into the clutches of winter. Not that the clutches of winter didn't already get here. I don't know if you watched any football over the weekend or anything else over the weekend. Checked in with our dear friend Maura up in New Jersey. She was knocked out of power about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and didn't get it back till about 11 o'clock on Sunday. That's frightening business. That freak snowstorm that freak nor'easter that blew up the coast. Yeah, we woke up Saturday morning and had a nice little skiff of snow. No, it wasn't nice, but it wasn't particularly aggravating either. But it got really, really ugly. Got a photograph of an absolutely snow-covered, tree-lined lane at Princeton. Cassie sent that along. It was just beautiful. You can see it at cassie@college.com. And you know, a lot of people were without power as a result of that storm. You know, heavy, wet snow, leaves still on the trees. It's sort of a situation that makes itself amenable to power outages. Yeah. But Moore is okay, and I hope all of you, I hope nobody was out of power for too very long. But don't worry, it's going to keep happening, because, you know, don't tell the teabaggers and the wingnuts and the fundies that global climate change is real. And it's really, you know, the more you see of this stuff, the more you realize that it's not global warming. That's an inappropriate, inarticulate term. It is climate change. It is things happening with the climate at times when they ought not be happening. Now, I'm not talking about when the Radio Rwanda has a conniption in January. Well, look, it's snowing in New York in January. I guess that that global warming sure would be nice to have some of that now, wouldn't it? No. No, it's the climate doing things the climate ought not be doing at particular times when the climate hasn't been doing it in the past. Well, that's way too complicated. On the other hand, as Marty just sent me in a note, I'd seen this earlier, you know, the Koch brothers have been funding climate change denial for quite some time now, only they funded... It's like that old line they teach you in law school about cross-examination. Never ask a question to which you do not know the answer. And the real art of cross-examination is knowing when to stop. The classic example being, and sir, you say that this hold-up artist was in front of you for how long? He was in front of you, didn't you say, for about 30 seconds? Yes, I said that. And yet, in 30 seconds, you gave a complete description of him. Well, yes, I did. Sir, how could you possibly give a complete description of somebody in 30 seconds? He had a gun in my face. I will remember him for the rest of my days, down to the last little whiskers on his face. You got to know when to stop asking the questions. Well, the Koch brothers apparently didn't. Because lo and behold, they went one study too far. One of the paid pet climate deniers, funded in large part by the Koch brothers, thank you, Marty, has a problem. He's spent years denying that the planet is generally warming. Global warming is an accurate term, it's just not an effective one. The only problem, Richard Muller is the guy's name. The only problem is that as a global warming skeptic, as a global climate change skeptic, he spent years denying all of this because, of course, his funders were from the filthy hydrocarbon industry. Only now he's seen the light, or perhaps felt the heat, might be more appropriate. The AP story reporting the study of the world's surface temperatures by Richard Muller was partially bankrolled by a foundation connected to global warming deniers. He pursued long-held skeptic theories in analyzing the data. He was spurred to action because of ClimateGate, a British scandal involving hacked emails of scientists. Yet he found that the land is 1.6 degrees warmer than in the 1950s. Those numbers from Muller, who works at the University of California, Berkeley and Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, match those by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA, two organizations which the teabaggers, the climate deniers, and the right wing generally would like to defund. Well, I don't need that information. He said he went even further back, studying readings from Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. His ultimate finding of a warming world to be presented at a conference today is no different from what mainstream climate scientists have been saying for decades. What's different, the AP reports, and why everyone from opinion columnists to The Daily Show is paying attention, is who is behind the study. One quarter of the $600,000 to do the research came from the Charles Koch Foundation, whose founder is a major funder of skeptic groups and the teabaggers. Okay, I said teabaggers. AP says tea party. The Koch brothers, Charles and David, one of whom looks surprisingly like that English actor from Get... Yeah, never mind. Charles and David run a large privately held company involved in oil and other industries producing sizable greenhouse gas emissions. Gee, they left out the frozen chicken breasts at Walmart from Koch Industries, lovingly dipped in crude oil before freezing. Mueller's research team carefully examined two chief criticisms by skeptics. One is that weather stations are unreliable. Oh, God. And the other, because weather, you know, those weather stations up there at Ice Station Zebra, you know, once you get into the first bottle of Aquavit, it's all over. From Aquavit to Aquavelva is a pretty short trip. The other is that cities, which create heat islands, were skewing the temperature analysis. The skeptics raised valid points, and everybody should have been a skeptic 2 years ago, Mueller said in a telephone interview. And now we have confidence that the temperature rise that had previously been reported had been done without bias. My only suggestion to Mr. Mueller, stay off small aircraft, and don't be looking for that Koch Brothers Christmas card in the mail this year. Well, what are you going to... It's reality, right? Yeah. It is Moran Monday, by the way, and a couple of dandies along the way. You may have seen this. I got the link from several people. Most recently, I got it from our chat room moderator, Lottie. Lottie noting, only in Texas. Well, maybe not. And people there wonder why the rest of the country makes fun of them. They must be getting soft there, too, because this guy left out the gays. What guy is that? Well, this moron. Oh, what a joy. Now, we're talking here about, well, let's just go to the radio ad.
Hello, friends and neighbors in Mason and surrounding counties. Attention, be a victor, not a victim. We will be having a beginner's concealed handgun class this coming Wednesday, October 26th, at Keller's Riverside Store on the beautiful Llano River. Classes start at 8:30 a.m. This is an all-day event. We will attempt to teach you all the necessary information you need to obtain your CHL and hopefully when you can use your weapon to defend yourself if the need arises. We also will give you your handgun proficiency test as needed to get your license. The cost for the course is $100. We accept cash, check, credit cards, gold and silver, and used guns. For information or to sign up, call Crockett Keller, 325-347-0055. If you are a socialist liberal and or voted for the current campaigner-in-chief, please do not take this class. You have already proven that you cannot make a knowledgeable and prudent decision as required under the law. Also, if you are a non-Christian Arab or Muslim, I will not teach you the class. Once again, with no shame, I am Crockett Keller, 325-347-0055. Thank you, and God bless America.
Yeah, I can smell a campaign ad and a campaign in the making, can't you, when I hear one, can't you? Yeah, Crockett Keller ain't going to teach no Muslims how to shoot no shooting guns. Because he don't want them to have concealed carry permits, nor no Obama voters. But as Lottie notes, he must be getting soft because he didn't say anything about how he wouldn't teach no homosexuals how to shoot a handgun. There's only one little problem here, as the article notes. Certain requirements come with being certified to teach this sort of thing. And that is handgun instructors are not allowed, under even the law of Texas no less, to refuse to teach the class to anyone based on the applicant's race, ethnicity, or religion. Oddly enough, their sexuality is wide open, but you know, dumb Crockett missed this. You got to wonder if it, you know, some of David Crockett's people came on down to Texas after the Alamo, if I recall the biography that I read correctly. And you got to wonder if this is some of his people, some of those people. I don't know. David Crockett's eldest son, David Crockett, became just a real knee-jerk right-wing fundamentalist freak because you know, he was worried about his daddy burning in the hail because daddy had never been much in the way of a fundy. Yeah, I know. So I wouldn't be surprised to find out that this clown was directly related somewhere down the line. Never a dull moment. But you know what? I bet you Mr. Crockett don't much care. Because the thing, and I kind of wanted to talk about this a little bit this evening because it's important. It sort of dawned on me over the weekend as I started pondering things like, and Lord knows our buddy Mike Malloy touched on it, and things like Mississippi's Ballot Initiative 26, various and sundry efforts to roll back the Affordable Care Act. Barack Obama does not belong on the ballot. You know, Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona says he has a secret plan to keep Obama off the ballot in November 2012. Details will be forthcoming as soon as more money rolls in. You get the idea? Yeah, because these things all do run together. And there are other manifestations of it, immigration being a principal one. Every last one of these things has something in common, and the commonality is that they are all in direct contravention of established federal law, which has primacy over state law under principles going all the way back to the seminal constitutional law case enunciated by Chief Justice Marshall and known to posterity as Marbury versus Madison. Marbury versus Madison says unequivocally that the Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land and that the final arbiter of what the Constitution means shall be the Supreme Court of the United States. If you've been paying attention, and I know many of you have, if you've been paying attention to Dr. Bill O'Brien's Prism West Virginia history series, and especially this past Tuesday, you know that one of the central features of everything that made everything fall apart prior to the Civil War in the 19th century, roughly 150 years ago, one of the central things that made everything fall apart was an enunciated doctrine called nullification. It was crazy then, and it's crazy now. But nullification said that, or asserted that, states with a grievance against laws passed by the Congress or enshrined into the Constitution could simply pass their own laws in the states, overturning or exceeding the federal law, and that there was nothing that the United States federal government could do about it. That is the heart and soul of nullification. That states could nullify acts of the federal government as applicable within their own jurisdictional state boundaries. Prior to the Civil War, mostly that was about slavery. There were some tariff issues as well, but the heart and soul of it was about slavery. And to a certain extent, the modern thrust toward nullification continues to be about slavery. Only now, as opposed to the rather blatant and outright horror of human bondage, now the slavery that is desired by the Deep South and the West and the Midwest and, you know, all those places that we generally refer to as Jesus Land is a little more subtle, but not much. Mississippi's Ballot Initiative 26 is a nullification act poised against Roe versus Wade and Griswold versus Connecticut. And it seeks to re-enslave women. All these nullificationist views of the Affordable Care Act are attempts to compel further economic slavery to for-profit insurance enterprises with no recourse. Yes, I know. Before you start sending the email saying, oh, but Bob, it compels people to buy for-profit insurance. Yes, it does. But it also imposes restrictions on those same for-profit insurance companies, like, you know, no pre-existing conditions. So that, for instance, someday I can get health insurance and they won't be able to say, oh, we're sorry, Bob, you've got a screwed up, your guts are a mess, and we're not going to cover anything relating to your insides. Oh, what? You had really? You had a mole removed? Well, the outsides are done too, but we'll be happy to take your check. Right. Immigration? Immigration is clearly and unequivocally established as the purview of the federal government, because it is a matter not of entry into Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Florida, Georgia, etc., but rather a question of entry into the United States of America. But Alabama and Georgia and Arizona, and depending on how these things play out in the courts, God knows all the other states in Jesus land, say, no, we have the right to pass draconian laws that effectively enslave or else drive out anyone we decide as a function of the tyranny of the majority in our several states that we don't like. Nullification. I mean, for Christ's sakes, you can't get a library card in Alabama without proving that you're Christian and white? And you can't, and this Crockett jackass in Texas, I ain't gonna teach you how to use no shooting gun unless you can prove that you love Jesus and you're white and American and never voted for that Obama campaigner in chief. But the question then is, once we recognize the issue for what it is, that in fact the South and its affiliated states, you know, because the U.S. is a little bit bigger now than it was back in 1860, Jesus land. The question is, what is Jesus land willing to do about it? And this being Halloween, I will submit to you that that is a frightening question, because the last time that Jesus land decided to do something about it, they got 600,000 Americans killed and God knows how many wounded. The economic devastation alone was monumental. Do they think that if they can just get one more Supreme Court justice that somehow the Supreme Court will reverse? I mean, do you realize what would have to happen in the Supreme Court in order for nullification to be held to be a valid legislative philosophy? And I'm not trying to be insulting or talking down or anything like that, but because it just stunned me when I started thinking about it. The Supreme Court functions as, since, you know, John Marshall did say, we will be the final word on what the Constitution says and means. By definition, they have to function on a theory called stare decisis, a respect for prior decisions of the court, in which precedent controls how future decisions are made. And the only way you overturn other cases that pre-exist is if you can prove them to be so clearly and erroneously and egregiously wrongly decided that they simply have to be thrown upon the ash heap of history. Things like the Dred Scott decision come to mind. Plessy versus Ferguson. The slaughterhouse cases. But you get the idea. In order for the South and its associated Jesus land states, In order for the South to succeed with it in its present nullificationist frenzy, it would require the overturning of everything about constitutional interpretive principle all the way back to Marbury versus Madison and McCulloch versus Maryland. That's saying a lot. It's just wiping the whole slate clean and starting over and saying nothing matters. We're going to go forward. I mean, labor law, for instance, is a place where it's established that the federal government has primacy. Insurance law, on the other hand, it's acknowledged that the states can make their own insurance laws, which, of course, is what has led us into a big part of the insurance mess that we have in this country. You've got 50 state insurance commissioners who can be bought off cheaply one at a time. But then again, federal government, state government, local government, you know, they want, because the green people want it all, they'll buy off anybody. I mean, don't think for a minute that having a centralized approach doesn't mean you get bought. All you have to think about, for instance, is George W. Dimwit's labor secretary, Elaine Chao. She's the Merkin for Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Chinless Mitch. Yeah, that came straight out of the labor-hating sector, she did. But the larger point is that nullification is a dangerous route to travel unless you have someone strong enough to stand up to these freaks and say no, and do what Andrew Jackson said and say I will hang the first nullificationist I find as high as Haman, as Jim noted on the program sometime last week. I don't think we've got that. I don't think under any circumstance that we've got that. I don't think Ronald Reagan would have. He fired the air traffic controllers, you know, for wanting to stop being abused on the job. But to stand up to a state and say no, uh-uh. Now, Tim from L.A. is telling me that Herr Crockett was on the Tom Hartman show today, and he backpedaled his racist diatribe. He said the comments, oh, isn't it always funny how they do this? The comments were tongue-in-cheek. Tim reports that when Hartman asked if he would teach Timothy McVeigh, he said in a roundabout way that he would not be able to tell if McVeigh was a bad person. I guess it's easier for Crockett Killer to point out who the lefties and Muslims are than to say, you know, that McVeigh, he's a crazy white supremacist, Tom and John Metzger, or Christian abortion sniper James Charles Kopp. And let's not forget the Atlanta bomber in the Olympic Village, Eric Robert Rudolph, who also bombed an abortion clinic and a lesbian nightclub in the Atlanta area. Yeah, you know, as long as, you know, if I see that they're white, it's real hard for me to figure out that they're bad. Isn't that what this boils down to? Yeah. No, that wasn't tongue-in-cheek. There were no tin whistles, no snare drums, no rim shots in that ad. Not hardly. See if you hear the
neighbors and Mason.
See if you hear the laugh lines here.
Vic Tim, we will be having a beginner's concealed handgun class this coming Wednesday, October 26th, at Keller's Riverside Store on the beautiful Llano River. Classes start at 8:30 a.m. This is an all-day event. We will attempt to teach you all the necessary information you need to obtain your CHL and hopefully when you can use your weapon to defend yourself if the need arises. We also will give you your handgun proficiency test as needed to get your license. The cost for the course is $100. We accept cash, check, credit cards, gold and silver, and used guns. For information or to sign up, call Crockett Keller, 325-347-0055. If you are a socialist liberal and or voted for the current campaigner-in-chief, please do not take this class. You have already proven that you cannot make a knowledgeable and prudent decision as required under the law. Also, if you are a non-Christian Arab or Muslim, I will not teach you the class. Once again, again with no shame. I am Crockett Keller.
Yeah, so I'm a non-Christian, but I'm not an Arab or a Muslim. Does that mean I can take Crockett Keller's class?
Then again, I voted for Obama. Maybe I could masquerade as a, as a Nader voter. Would that get me into class? Jeebus.
Yeah, there's another one, Tim. What happens if you're a Christian Arab?
You know, they do have those. Coptics and so forth.
There was a whole community of them in one of the oldest in the world in Iraq. Back before George Bush decided to bomb the snot out of them and run them all out and destroy that 2,000-year-old community.
Yeah, and they weren't subjected to pogroms or
no.
You're right, though, Lottie. His store looks like something from Gruesome Culture.
So that's where we find ourselves this Moran Monday. Chief Moran in Chief Crockett Keller. And what's the name of that store?
Keller's Riverside Store, where we accept cash, checks, money orders, credit cards, gold, silver, family heirlooms. Don't be trying to palm off any of that old silver plate on me. If you're going to bring the family dinnerware, by God, it better be sterling. I can tell. Buffalo pelts, beaver hides, and used firearms. Because, see, we're libertarian that way. We can exist in a border economy.
Jeebus.
Funny thing is, it's a concealed handgun class, though. Can't teach you anything about using an unmodified semi-automatic AK-47 to mow down folks in a bank parking lot or anything. Or use a shotgun to blow away children in a Unitarian Universalist Church's attempt to put on Annie. No, that's not one of your handgun attacks. That's a separate class. So here it is, Halloween on the horn, and we will. The lines are open. Moran Monday, spooky stuff we can do, whatever. Before we go to the break, yeah, a little bit more scary stuff. From Edgar Allan Poe. Thank heaven. The crisis, the danger is past. And the lingering illness is over at last. And the fever called living is conquered at last. Sadly, I know I am shorn of my strength, and no muscle I move as I lie at full length, but no matter, I feel I am better at length. And I rest so composedly now in my bed that any beholder might fancy me dead, might start at beholding me, thinking me dead. The moaning and groaning, the sighing and sobbing are quieted now with that horrible throbbing at heart. Oh, that horrible, horrible throbbing. The sickness, the nausea, the pitiless pain have ceased with the fever that maddened my brain, with the fever called living. That burned in my brain. And oh, of all tortures that torture the worst has abated, the terrible torture of thirst for the naphthalene river of passion accursed. I have drank of a water that quenches all thirst. Of a water that flows with a lullaby sound, from a spring, but a very few feet underground, from a cavern not yet very far down underground. And ah, let it never be foolishly said that my room, it is gloomy and narrow my bed, for man never slept in a different bed, and to sleep you must slumber in just such a bed. My tantalized spirit here blandly reposes, forgetting, or never regretting its roses, its old agitations of myrtles and roses. For now, while so quietly lying, it fancies a holier odor about it, of pansies, a rosemary odor, commingled with pansies, with rue, and the beautiful Puritan pansies. And so it lies happily bathing it, many a dream, bathing in many a dream of the truth and the beauty of Annie, drowned in a bath of the tresses of Annie. She tenderly kissed me, she fondly caressed, and then I fell gently to sleep on her breast, deeply to sleep from the heaven of her breast. When the light was extinguished, she covered me warm, and she prayed to the angels to keep me from harm, to the queen of the angels to shield me from harm. And I lie so composedly now in my bed, knowing her love, that you fancy me dead. And I rest so contentedly now in my bed, with her love at my breast, that you fancy me dead, that you shudder to look at me, thinking me dead. But my heart, it is brighter than all of the many stars in the sky, for it sparkles with Annie. It glows with the light of the love of my Annie, with the thought of the light of the eyes of my Annie.
This is the Horn. The Head-On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Bubble Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And got their bath and body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Ahead of his game, he was Edgar Allan Poe. Way out ahead. In fact, for those wondering, you know, after a while, it begins to become an open question as to whether anyone artistically ever absolutely creates anything out of thin air. And just in looking at the list of titles by Edgar Allan Poe, I was struck by something. Consider this: there's a short story that he wrote called The Facts in the Case of Monsieur Valdemar. Really, Ed? Valdemar? Yeah, really, Valdemar. And we thought that Voldemort in the Harry Potter series was a creation strictly from the mind of the author. No, of course not. And it doesn't hurt that Monsieur Valdemar is a dead man who yet speaks to the narrator in the story. See what I mean? Everything is derivative of everything else. So we are a couple of minutes ahead of the 7 o'clock hour here on the East Coast, the beginning of the second hour of the program. It's Halloween on the horn. Sad to say, I'm not really in costume. I should have given it some thought, and I would have been. But at any rate, happy Halloween to you. Let's go to the phones, see what folks have to say. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Hi, I didn't expect to get on so soon. I'm still on the bus. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Hi, this is Paul from Portland, the bad chemist.
Oh, hey, how are you, Paul?
Oh, just fine. This is my first time I called in. I've been so busy with the grad schedule that it's just hard to find a time, Pacific time, between your show to give the call live.
I understand. I'm awfully glad you did, though, and you picked a great evening to do it.
Oh, thanks. I also wanted to wish the Horn a happy birthday. I know it's a little late, but I was buried in insurance last week.
I can well understand. It is that time of year, isn't it?
Yeah. So if I hear that right, you can trade your guns in for a concealed weapon class?
Yeah. Are you as perplexed by that as I am?
My only question is if you have to bring the guns out in the open and not conceal them. Otherwise, do you fail the class right away?
Well, I was just wondering, after you traded in your gun, I mean, it's kind of like, what is that O. Henry story, that classic, the Gift of the Magi? Remember where she sells her hair to buy him a fob for his watch, the young newlywed couple that are desperately poor? She sells her hair to buy him a fob for his treasured watch, and he sells his treasured watch to buy her some sort of gym crack for her hair. So after you've traded in your gun to get your concealed weapon permit, what do you conceal?
Pocket knife, maybe?
Yeah, right, exactly. I don't know. One of those stick blenders that they use on the cooking channel all the time. I'm not afraid. I'll blend you in a minute, buddy.
No, no, that just perplexed me. You know, the gold, the silver, the old guns. Did he say he'd take cash, or is that against the law? Because
no, he's still
his thing.
Yeah, he's still taking that federal funny money.
Okay, because it seems like the rules for what we pay people with change daily. Apparently, in a couple of states, you can't use cash to buy used items anymore.
I noticed that. What was what state was that? Louisiana? Yeah. Yeah, you can't use cash to buy secondhand goods.
No, given that it's Halloween, you could talk about some scary stuff, but for me, the scariest stuff is the reality of the situation we're living in. And being in the science world, you kind of have to deal with the reality on a much closer level. It's hard to deny what's going on around you since you spend your time investigating what's going on around you.
Right. Reality is a very frightening thing. And, of course, I think, Paul, that goes back to the heart of why we tell ourselves scary stories, is because reality is frightening enough as it is. And, you know, going back as far, well, I guess it was Aristotle who enunciated the concept of catharsis, wherein an audience watching something horrible happen on stage feels as if it's happening to them and therefore are cleansed of their irrational fears and their terrors and everything, and they walk away from the theater feeling ever so much better.
I've heard of it. I don't know about the quote itself.
Yeah, that's why you sit on it. That's why you sit there in mute horror and you watch as Yocasta kills herself when she realizes that she's been sleeping with her own son, you know, Oedipus, and then later on, you know, Oedipus goes off stage and he gouges out his eyes and he comes out all creepy and blind, and the audience sits there and goes, "Wow, I'm glad that's not me, but that sure is awful." And so, you know, that's the made up stuff. Because, like you said, the reality on the ground is terrifying. I mean, for God's sakes, we have drowning islands, I mean, the Arctic melting, you know, faster than they thought in the first place.
Oh, yeah, I don't want to scare people with that. You know, I'm tangentially have some contacts in the whole environmental science thing, and the conversation is quickly turning from how do we innovate our way out of this or find green technology and, you know, thwart climate change to basically how are we going to protect ourselves from what's already coming? You know, kind of the James Hansen view that, you know, you need to be at 350, you're at 384, so you need to start thinking about how to insulate yourself from the changes that are already going to happen rather than how to stop the changes from happening in the first place. You pass that windmill.
And I mean, there is evidence everywhere. I read a story over the weekend talking about Miami and what climate change means for Miami. Miami, without, you know, on cloudless days now, no rain, no nothing, the storm sewers are filling up from the tide and flooding streets in the Miami Beach area. No rain, just the tides. And it's a function of the fact that Miami Beach is slowly being drowned. And so, you know, when we think about what will happen with population pressures, you know, nothing ever good comes, Paul, from massive populations being displaced and having to go somewhere else, because there's always a loser.
I'm having a hard time picturing a winner in that scenario.
So, you know, well, I mean, in this particular case, the hypothesis posited will be that the poorer elements, or the poverty areas of Miami at present, will the people who live there, who happen to live on the high ground where the railroad was, places like Overtown, will be displaced by condominiums and rich people, because that ongoing tenet of the horn comes into play, and I think it comes into play with all of this. They want it all, especially when it's their butts on the line.
Well, Bill Hicks used to say that if California ever had the big one, it would just become Arizona Bay. If Miami Beach goes into the ocean, what do we call that?
Gulf of Mexico? I mean, there's really no, at least there's Arizona behind California. There ain't nothing behind Florida but more water. That's the tough part of being a peninsula.
Well, I think I always often ask people that are, you know, climate change deniers, what will it take, you know, what level will you have to get to accept it's happening? And if Disney World is suddenly beachfront property, will that be enough?
And, you know, the sad thing, Paul, is, I mean, do you get any kind of an answer from them? Because I think climate change denial is one of those places where there are none so blind as those who will not see. And beachfront property in Orlando just means that that'll be better property values in the area. And, gosh, somebody can make some money. Because isn't that the measure of their entire universe? The question of, can we make some money on this?
That's always a factor. It infuriates me sometimes. So to have that said, we got to make some cash on this. You hear that all the time in the research thing of, you know, that's always the last question on a grant and always the most important question, you know. How will this make money, and or how do you think this will make money or pay for itself given the investment we're about to give? After you've gone through all the science and all your hypothesis and all your discovered so far and the budget and the bill and everything and what it, you know, back to, you know, how will this make a profit sometimes is how it checks out in the end.
I didn't realize it was that bad even in academia. That's kind of depressing, Paul.
Well, in academia, academia gets their funding from NIH government grants and private sponsors. And so the government grants have been getting less and less because of the budget cuts. So NIH has been handing out less money, and you've been having to go, professors have been having to go to the private sector more. And whenever you go, I've worked on a grant for a professor years ago that was getting his money strictly from the private sector. And his, you know, that was a big question we had to answer is, you know, they were going to give $50,000 for this experiment, and they wanted to know how they're going to get their money back, basically.
You know, come to think of it, you're right, because what comes to mind is something I heard in a seminar a couple of months back, and that is that all grantors are now looking to find out how the effort will sustain itself once the grant money is gone.
Oh, yeah, because it's just, it's more and more difficult to get a lab going at, like, the school I'm going to run a lab. You're having to get multiple grants from multiple sources, and sometimes the grad students are trying to pay for themselves. There's a classmate of mine literally writing a grant to basically to pay for his salary on the lab, because at the school I go to, my Fordham State, the grad students don't pay tuition. They get a stipend and they work for the school full-time, and they go to be a student full-time. And that comes out of the lab fund for whatever lab they work for, and sometimes they have to get grants for themselves just to, you know, keep going.
You know, that's another one of those signposts toward the apocalypse, Paul. When you cannot pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge, but you must somehow have a commercialized, capitalized motive behind it, you know, I would hazard a guess that the vast majority of the great advances in science were not arrived at on a for-profit motive. Is that safe to assume?
A lot of them, yes, because a lot of it is discovery. Like that, one of my favorite quotes from West Wing from like the second season, where Sam is talking about, you know, 100 years ago, they discovered the electron, and it, they didn't have any profit motive for it. They didn't know what it was supposed to do or anything. They just discover it, and 100 years later, we have a world run on electronics and technology. And you can't predict that. You can't profitize that. Some of the greatest changes have just become because scientists have been researching, and they stumble on something that's interesting, and a few years later, it's developed into something even better, and then suddenly you've got a whole new technology. And that's kind of how it works. And I don't like the idea, because people with that grant money want to control stuff and want a direction and a path, and it doesn't work that way. I mean, even Viagra, the money maker that it is, started out as research for basically lowering blood pressure, making blood pressure medication, and it had an interesting side effect. And that side effect has made millions and millions of dollars.
Right, because the nature of science is that it cannot have a preconceived end, right? It has to. You know, you have a hypothesis, but it's not a sure thing, and you subject it to testing, and you come out with an answer, but not necessarily the answer. The one I always think about is the war materiels scientists during the Second World War, who were trying to come up with a replacement for naturally derived rubber from latex, from rubber trees, And they came up with silly putty. Silly putty was originally meant to be a replacement for rubber for tires. And it didn't work out, but it went on to make millions as a children's toy and many happy hours of lifting reverse images of the comics off of Sunday papers.
Yes, science is unpredictable. And if you're looking for a profit, you need a prediction.
In a way, it's just an extrapolation. Nothing ever changes, Paul. It's an extrapolation of the same thing that that Columbus dealt with. Not that I'm any fan of Christopher Columbus, but he went on his voyage of exploration, promising the Spanish crown that, well, we're going to get in on the spice trade, and maybe we'll find some gold. And so even though he didn't, he had to come back and tell the Spanish crown, well, I've certainly set out, I've accomplished my goals, I have found a trade route to Asia. When it never was Asia, and the gold was yet to be discovered, it still had to be pigeonholed into that end justifies the means sort of approach. And, you know, that's in excess of 500 years ago now. And it's, we are, I fear, Paul, sort of hamstringing ourselves by virtue of the fact that we're not seeking knowledge for the sake of knowledge. And that's always dangerous.
I agree. It corrupts the system.
And so if I recall from one of your recent correspondences, you graduate this summer?
I do in June. And I'm trying to apply to PhD programs and look for jobs at the same time, since I'm a little shaky on the economy at the moment.
Well, that's what I was yeah, you might want to stay in academia as long as possible, because it's brutal out here, but you know that already.
I spent a year and a half, jobless and not doing anything, trying to figure out a way out of the box I was in before I got accepted a couple summers ago. And, you know, my only regret for Occupy Portland is that if they did it just a little bit earlier, I could have had time to go down there with them, and now I kind of have to watch them from the science building and go, I wish I was there, but I just can't move from here. I work 60 hours a week trying to get all the stuff done.
Brutal. But you know what? That's okay. That's okay, because support as you can, and others, you know, it's not a hard and fast. Everybody who's there hasn't been there all along. People move in, people come out, people go in, and at some point in time, if it's right for you to be there, you know what? You'll be there.
Yeah. But hopefully, it'll last longer past June. I think it will.
That's the real kick here. I think it has staying power, and I think in places like Portland, Seattle, L.A., San Francisco, and even New York with winter coming on. I think it'll still be there. Although the cops in New York, I don't know if you've seen this or not, the cops in New York are trying a new tactic, and it's really sleazy. They're telling all of New York's homeless population to go to Zuccotti Park.
The Occupy movement is?
Yes. And and then they will in turn say, well, you know, we got a homeless problem here. We got to clear everybody out. Yeah, it's really, really nasty. But it's go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that might bite them in the butt. it's just making them bigger, stronger, and making them more aware of the homeless population, and going to have more people communicating and talking about different things. I think that's the biggest thing of Occupy Wall Street. It's almost kind of like an on-the-ground version of your show. It's people coming together while the Occupy is going and sharing ideas and growing together and talking about things. And the more people you put into that mix from different backgrounds, the more powerful it becomes rather than the weaker it becomes.
Exactly. And I don't think the 1% still have much of a clue. And I don't know if being there till 3 years from now will give them a clue. But we don't have to. The one thing that's important is we don't have to give the 1% a clue. We have to give Middle America a clue. You know, the folks with the couches and their butts implanted thereupon.
Oh, I think that, you know, we are the 99% is the perfect motto. I think that those are the people you have to give a clue to, because Occupy Wall Street or the Occupy movement might only be 20 or 30 or 40%, pick a number, of the populace. And once it gets to the 99% or even before that, then it's over. You'll never convince the 1%. It doesn't say we are the 99% against the 1%. It's just we are the 99%. That's the focus. Those are you have to convince.
Exactly. And when not only Warren Buffett, but a guy like Bill Gates says, you know, we really should raise taxes on my class. I don't think it engenders a lot of sympathy. I can imagine somebody with somebody saying, well, that's well and good for Bill Gates. He's a billionaire, but I've only got 50 million.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. Well, what's that old W.C. Fields line? I always like to give to the poor. Poor me. Right. Yeah.
Your comments, and you may or may not know this, your comment about they want it all whenever you say it, there's going to be a very obscure reference, but I just wanted to share it with you. I'm like in my early 30s, and so grew up on 80s cartoons, and I remember something that stuck in my mind as a kid. There was a Captain Caveman cartoon for a while.
Oh, God, I remember Captain Caveman.
Yeah, there was an episode where the villain that Captain Caveman was fighting was like a very greedy caveman. And the first time you see him, he's like panhandling. It's like a panhandling beggar on the street trying to get more money and just more money and more money, you know, because just to feed himself. And then, like, after people pass by, a big, like, you know, Flintstone-type limousine pulls up and he gets in it. And he's like the villain. And he's got so much money from his businesses and his profit from his businesses that he can't get any more profit. And the only way for him to increase his profit margin even more is to basically take the change out of people's pockets by pretending to be a beggar. And eventually he's trying to use his money to build like a money magnet to suck up all the money. And then Captain Caveman has to stop him.
You know what? I'm going to have to. I will go. I bet you I can find that on YouTube. There might be some valuable dialogue in that, Paul.
Yeah, it just reminds me of, you know, because at a certain point, that's how you're going to get more of it, is just begging on the street to get the last few bits of change that we have left.
Well, that's why I think of so many of these Randians and Rand Paul in particular as being very much akin to Daffy Duck, you know, with him sitting there leaping through piles of gold coins, screaming, "I'm rich! I'm rich! I'm comfortably well off." You know, that's all they want. Just comfortably well off. Let's not call it something so off-putting as rich.
I've got a scarier analogy that's also Looney Tunes. I see it as that vulture character that is just waiting around for people to die.
Yeah.
And whenever they ever try to convince him, don't eat me, he's like, oh, no, 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 no.
No, no, can't do that. Can't do that. My mama done told me.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it just, like, it's like, let's raise taxes. No, can't do that. Can't do that. Nope, nope, nope. And it's just, waiting for someone to die so they can eat.
Jesus. Hey, Paul, you have yourself a great evening, brother. I'm glad you called, and I hope you will again when time permits.
Happy Halloween, Bob.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Paul calling from Portland. And moving onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, happy Halloween, Moran Monday, Brother Bob.
Indeed, Brother Albert. How's it going?
Hey, I'll tell you, it's going good. Paul really took me down memory lane on that. I remember that episode. I remember it clear as day. I was just watching it. I was like, oh, my God, I forgot about that one. Yeah, I remember that one. And it's exactly right. It's these people, what is going on? What's happening? Bob, I know you dropped my brain down the stairs with the Lindsey Graham talking about going into the Libyan market now. But, I mean, is it just completely falling apart? Is it the most hysterical thing you've ever seen? Herman Cain? What is he doing? What is that?
There's a reason that Herb favorably cited Clarence Thomas as the guy, as the justice that he would appoint other justices to emulate.
Goodness gracious. It's unbelievable. Who's that guy?
Settlement? That guy, what settlement?
Yes. Yeah, oh, you mean that settlement?
Yeah, right.
Goodness.
I plum forgot about that. Yep.
So Rush, is this just complete, unbelievably unabashed evil liberal racism? Is that what's going on here?
My friends, it's the second coming of the high-tech lynching of Clarence Thomas. I tell you, that's what it is.
That one didn't even hold together for 4 hours. They're done.
Worse than Jell-O in the sun.
Goodness gracious. It's going to be the Straits of Miami. And, you know, as you're talking with Paul and, you know, and you're talking about arguing with people. Like, he asked the question, like, well, what's it going to take? Brother, Paul, they show you graphs that clearly demonstrate that the temperature is freaking raising. And they tell you it's the other thing. Who are you going to believe, your lying eyes or me? That's what they do constantly. You ever seen anyone try to do that to you in an argument online regarding global warming?
Well, that's, you know what? You probably found that on some liberal website. I ain't believing it.
No, they post it. They will post it. They will show a graph. The graph clearly shows a trend of upwards. And they'll tell you it's going the other way. There's nothing you can show them. Nothing. The Straits of Miami. I mean, if they have their way, the problem is it's going to bite them in the ass. But the Straits of Miami, they'll just say, oh, it'll be cheaper to ship all that tar sand oil from Texas to Europe or wherever.
Yeah, well, you know, what we're doing is we're expanding the Gulf Stream here.
We're pumping it up. We're adding some more hot water with them shallows. That's what they're going to do. You know,
that's more land that's more land that we can drill for offshore oil on now. See, yeah, we couldn't drill in Florida because of them precious alligators and baby popcorn shrimp and all of that crap, but they're gone now, baby, and we can drill, baby, drill.
Uh-huh. And I guess we found out what, what's that little Weasley schmucktard pimp wannabe, everything good in the world killer, what's that kid's name, O'Keefe?
Yeah.
So I guess we found out the footage he captured when he was down on Occupy Wall Street, right?
Yeah.
You saw that commercial, right?
Right.
Yeah. He finds the most crazy people. He probably paid a couple of those guys a hot dog. Speaking of, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, a hot dog and talk about the Jews. I mean, have you ever seen it so obviously just, I mean, like.
Yeah, like there were cue cards behind him? Right, yeah.
I mean, well, it's just so transparent. It's so desperate. I mean, Rush Limbaugh at least has some bass in his voice when he does it. You know, to make you think, oh, he really believes what he's saying. I mean, I can't even. You watch.
I think what you're getting at is, will you guys at least put some effort into it?
God, exactly. Try. Just try a little bit. God, I'd love to. You know, give me a reason to not vote for Obama. Go ahead. That's where I'm at now. It's like I'm sticking my jaw out. Okay, come on. Just one thing. Just hit me once. It keeps like, are you serious? What is this?
I've got a thing here. Speaking of O'Keefe, there's another clown out there. You know what pajamas media is? It's like this right wing, but they're hip, right? So I got this video the other day, and I'm not going to play it. But, I mean, this is right wing, and they found themselves a black dude by the name of Alfonso Rachel. Or maybe, whatever. And so he posts this video the other day on pajamas media. Outshining the Tea Party? Privileged white kids dominate Occupy Wall Street. Privileged white kids. Kettle, have you met?
I'll tell you, they don't understand what this all is. You know, we all know that there's no way that they can admit that they know what Occupy Wall Street's about, because then that would bring up some massive issues they don't want to talk about. You know, they may want to suck up all the money in the world, but you and I know, I mean, when you have science applying for profit marketability grants, that shit can't go. That's not how it works.
Oh, I know. David in Tennessee just wrote in a few minutes ago, Albert, and he went to the same place you're going. He said, those crafty Randians. The path they want us all to tread is now well marked. Underfund government. Government underfunds research. Private funding must be pursued. To do any research at all, the private funder gets to fund so as to get the answers his interests want. Need an example? See Koch brothers, voila, system gamed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But speaking of that, we just had a climate, stand the climate, right? The climate denier scientist, I didn't catch his name. I read the article this weekend. Koch played for whatever it is, Koch, whatever they are. They paid for a quarter of his study, and he was, for a couple years there, you know, a denier. Now he comes out and he says, well, the evidence is undeniable. It's happening.
Yeah, Richard Mueller.
Well, is that the guy?
Yeah.
Well, see, at least somebody has a little bit of a, you know, I mean, that's what I mean. How can you look? The graph shows it. It's going up. That's what the trend is, you dummy.
And thank you very much to the Associated Press for burying the damn lead, okay? So the lead that the Associated Press has is a prominent physicist and skeptic of global warming spent 2 years trying to find out if mainstream climate scientists were wrong. Okay, that's what passes for a lead in for-profit Associated Press journalism. This is Seth Borenstein writing. Meanwhile, you get down halfway into the body of the piece, this is what it means when they say they buried the lead. Mueller said greenhouse gases could have a disastrous impact on the world. Hello?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the lead, isn't it? Yeah, when you've got a guy who has been paid for years to deny real peer-reviewed climate science, and he finally finds, so to speak, the foot of the cross and says greenhouse gases could have a disastrous impact on the world, that's the lead of the story, isn't it, Albert?
It most certainly is, but it's not the front of it. The front of it is ex-big oil, you know, hack shill now says, there you go, greenhouse gases have a devastating blah, blah, blah. You just got to get that hack shill because that's what he is. And how many times, did you see that, I don't know, hang on, speaking of these climate hack shills, did you see that British comedy show just rip apart Lord Monckton to say that Lord Monckton, Mr. Lord Monckton, is actually, what's his name? I can't think, what's his name? Sasha Cohen. Baron Cohen.
Right? Monckton, Throckmorton, whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and they're interviewing him. They're like, "Yeah, can I just get an LEG, you know, for old time's sake?" You know, go check it out if you haven't seen it. It's pretty funny stuff. But you know, that's what I mean. It's like, seriously, who are these people? You know, who are these people that you're going to sit there? You know, you can't even. They don't even want to argue with you anymore. They used to want to. They don't want to anymore. They know where. They know what's going down. Now they're just trying to grab as much as they can before they can run off to the island. But I'm
the island. The island being, you know, us in another right.
Yeah. Well, that's pushing us off. And you know, that's how they're going to make the island, pushing us off with bulldozers. But
well, I mean, that's what that article about Miami Beach said. It said that Overtown, mm-hmm. which is my neighbor having been there, sort of complicates matters. But it's my understanding that Overtown is kind of a tough neck of the woods. Well, it's not going to be. It's going to have Gucci and Coach and all that fun stuff that's down in South Beach now. When South Beach is underwater, it's going to be in Overtown, and the people who are in Overtown now are going to be where?
I don't know. Brother Bob, I kind of see, that's what I mean. That's bring it up. I don't even know how to tell you the answer. We got 7 billion people here on the planet. Now we got 7 billion people, and now we're making changes, and it's going to affect vast majorities of us. And that affecting us, that pain that's going to cause, is going to cause for change. That's going to be a call for change. People are going to say, no, we can't do this anymore. I mean, come on, how long has capitalism been on complete life support? I just watched another dispatch from out in the UK over there, one of their documentary investigative journalism shows, and they were talking about how much money our banking, just to get the whole picture of this whole thing, it's just ridiculous. Our country over here, our market, these guys vaporized $14 trillion. Conservative estimate is $14 trillion, right? That's the lowest you'll hear. The margins are always higher than that, always. And we're talking 10 to 1. Banks don't loan out at 10 to 1 margins on nonsense derivative default swap crap that they just fabricate out of thin air? That they built to fail, and then they get insurance from us to fail on this. I mean, come on, this thing's
but
dead.
But be careful, there, Albert, when you talk about they vaporized that money.
Well, true.
See, I don't think that money. I don't think that money disappeared. I think it just went somewhere else. Because you know the law of conservation of mass and energy says that it didn't just disappear unless it was completely imaginary in the first place.
That's the thing, though. I mean, if you actually want to get into some of the man who Schechter, he's a good little documentary filmmaker. He made the one about life and debt with the credit card, and he just made a new one. I think it's called Treason. You should watch it. It showed. I mean, in their estimates, they're talking 100. I mean, I'd said 10 to 1 margin. 10 to 1 margin of $14 trillion is $140 trillion. There's not that much money on the planet, Bob. They fabricated it. They're like birds. They fabricate all this big mess, but they've only eaten, 2% of it. But that 2% that they created was so massive that, they do have money. They're getting their bonuses. We bailed them out. They're still getting their bonuses. In England, they got their – they didn't even talk, because England has their Brown, which is their – right, that's conservative guy, right? Brown?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's buddy buddies with the City of London. They didn't talk any kind of, hey, let's slow down or let's make these bonuses, moderate and, conservative here. No, they didn't have any talk of anything like that. The damn guy, what was he, Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS, right? Oh, expand. It would be like, whatever the local, credit union for you is in West Virginia expanding to become, Wells Fargo or something like that. And that's what he did. And they bought everyone, NatWest and everything. And they already knew all the crap these guys did.
The funny thing out of all this is that there are object lessons right in front of the right wingers' eyes about, mm-hmm. Cautionary tales of why not to do this sort of thing. And one of the things that comes to mind is Herb Cain. Okay, he was brought in apparently at the same time that he was pubic hairs and Coke cans, whatever his hero Clarence Thomas was doing. I got an email from Michael Kid A from the chat room saying Bob, Herb Cain is going as Clarence Thomas for Halloween.
But he was brought in by Pillsbury, and Pillsbury owned Godfather's Pizza, and they had, you know, retail stores in strip malls and stuff. And he was brought in specifically because they had overexpanded. They had too many stores, and they were losing money. They had expanded too fast. And he was brought in as the hatchet man who would cleave their workforce by half and return them to quote-unquote profitability.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
the examples are there. You can't just go on all, you know, stage five metastasizing cancer with your business model. Because that's what it is. If you overheat and overexpand, it will collapse on its own, of its own weight.
Yeah, no doubt. And now we're seeing that we're meeting the threshold of what the world can handle in terms of, you know, its capacity. We mean capacity by quality of life. I mean, how much quality of life are we going to have when, I mean, New York is what? New York City is 10 feet off the water, 15, 20 feet off the water. That's it. It's an island. You know what I mean? Miami, what are they? They're a foot above sea level. You know, they're not the only ones, and we know all around the world, right? Poor Sri Lanka, oh my God. Can you imagine with these poor people? They're already below sea level, and now India's taking all their water away from them with dams and everything else. They're damming the Ganges. You know, I mean, so we're sitting there seeing this planet. I mean, what are they going to start doing? They're going to start executing all of us? Who's going to do this?
No, I don't think they're going to do. No. No, it'll just
revolution.
It'll be a bit of a die off, I think.
You think it'll be a die off? Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be. And this is not the Alex Jones portion of the program, I might add.
No, it's just Halloween. We're talking.
Right, it's Halloween. Right. No, it'll be a die off. It won't necessarily be disease or plague or anything like that. It'll be that they've got the stuff and we don't, and the people who lack the power to leverage the stuff will die. I mean, we're not to the Logan's Run bubble cities yet.
Yeah, see, I don't think we'll get there. I think it'll all blow up in their faces far before that. You know, we want to see a Star Trek future. And that, you know, Star Trek kind of shows us that we don't have to go, you know, Logan's Run. Star Trek is showing us that, and we already know this right now. We're there. We're right on the cusp of these things. You know, you sit there, you think, oh, what'd you say, 500 years Christopher Columbus, look at us now, right? 100 years ago, the electron, look at us now. 150 years, the electron, now look at us. And we've barely begun to tap into the electron. This is just the very beginning of it. And we don't know how fast this technology is increasing. And all I'm saying is, you know, we already have Star Trek technology right now. Right now. And there's things in there, you know, we're just going to have to sit there and say, well, New York City can grow its own food. Because they can. It's all there. All this stuff is right there. It just needs people to sit there and just have a different, just a slightly different perception on it. What are we here for spinning around in space on this planet? What are we doing? To make money that you're never going to be able to take with you to anywhere? Is that what the point is? I don't think that's the point. I don't think that's the future. I really don't. I think we're going to start, you know, we're going to be able to do something. We'll have local economy, sure. But I don't think people are going to be, you know, aspiring to be billionaires anymore. I just don't, you know, I can't see it. There's no future there. And we're going to go to where there's future, just like a plant, right? You put it in the basement, but it's going to grow to the light. It's going to grow to that window, you know. And if you turn it around, it'll turn around itself.
You know,
what life is going to do.
You are challenging Preston for horn resident optimist, Albert. but you remind me of something. I was up at the little convenience store the other day. As an aside, I'm trying to slowly wean myself back onto caffeine. I don't know why. I'm fresh out of vices and I need a new one. So I was getting a bottle of tea flavored, you know, sweetened with sugar, not high fructose corn syrup. And I can tolerate it and I'm really happy about it. And so I'm on the way out of the store and this, you know, this ties into something that our good friend Robert in Kitakyushu, Japan has mentioned from time to time. He told a story once, and I had been talking to Agnes about it, about the complete cultural disconnect there is in say how the culture works in Japan versus how it works in the United States. And I told her the story that Robert had told on the air here of how they saw a flash drive sitting on the ground,
And, of course, Robert mentioned that, you know, his children have been raised in Japan, in Japanese culture, and not in the American culture. And they saw the flash drive, and I guess Robert was just going to drop it in his pocket or something. And the kid said, no, Daddy, we have to go down to the police and turn it in there in case, because, you know, that belongs to someone, and they might need it. And that's what they did. And so I'm walking out of the little convenience store, and there's, you know, two wet $1 bills laying on the pavement. Now, what's the ordinary American response to that?
Hey, whoopee, mine.
Right. You know, there's even a TV commercial now, Albert, where they're filming a guy who finds money laying on the ground, and they tell, and I think it's a bank commercial, no less.
I like money.
Right. Well, you know, that's great, Albert, but I don't think we've got time for it. Never mind. So I picked it up and walked back, you know, because I picked it up, and like an American, I was about to stick it in my pocket, and then I remembered Robert's story, and I walked back in and said, because there were several people milling around in the convenience store, did any of you have any money fall out of your pocket? Oh, no, I reckon it's yours, buddy. And I just walked up to the counter because, you know, I didn't want that karma, you know, I didn't want that karmic thing happening for me. So I took the $2 and I walked up and set it on the counter and said, you know, if somebody comes in and says they lost money, because you know what? I've been down to my last $2.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts if you suddenly don't have it anymore. So I said, you know what, I'm going to leave this here. If somebody comes by and says they lost it, you know, tell them somebody put it back instead of sticking it in their own pocket. And they kind of looked at me like I was a Martian.
Yeah.
And I turned around and walked out. And I feel much better for having done it. Now, this is not, you know, Bob's little moment of trying to transition into Jesus or anything.
No, but that's good.
You know, little moments of altered behavior. And the reason I go through all of that, Albert, is that is what you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
You know, when you've got if you've got a classroom full of first graders, what do you want to be, Johnny? I want to be a policeman. What do you want to be, Susie? I want to be a doctor. What do you want to be, Janie? I want to be an astronaut. How about you, Timmy? I want to be a billionaire. Well, that's when you have the talk with Timmy. Because Timmy's getting off on the wrong foot.
Yeah.
Sure, everybody wants to be materially comfortable. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But if you start out, I mean, that's, you know, six-year-olds who want to be billionaires. I mean, is there anybody out there that thinks that Lucy in Peanuts, you know, Charlie Brown, that she was normal? Lucy was a freaking psychopath. You know,
not a hero.
Yeah, we're coming up on the holiday season, and everybody remembers that scene in Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown, where she is giving out advice, you know, because she's a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Brown asks her, what do you want for Christmas? And she says, with this big, psychotic grin on her face, real estate. You know, this, you know, and the football thing, she's a psycho. That overarching desire for stuff, the willingness to run over or trick or fool whoever she did, that is a manifestation of mental illness. And, you know, frankly, wanting to be...
American Psycho.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's about damn time that we start looking at the Flush Flemballs and the Hannitys of the world and explain to them that there's a difference between wanting to be comfortable and wanting it all. That there is something mentally wrong with they're wanting sick. To be a billionaire.
Yeah, they're sick. They're sick in the head. They are. There's no way that you can have $200 million and you can't go have a good time for the rest of your life and still see to the financial security of everyone you love.
Exactly. See, we used to have that in this country, and it was manifested inside the marginal tax rates. Because the marginal tax rates were a national manifestation and realization that there's a level of money above which you really don't have any business with it. And that when you get to that, that you're a danger, that you are a danger to the body politic and the body social.
Amen. Well, Brother Bob, look at what they're trying to look at the deal they're trying to make on us. 9%, right? Isn't that 999, right? 9%?
Yeah.
They're going to want to pay that 9%. What is that? If you add all that up, what is that, 28%? That's less, even less. And guess what? It'll happen again. And they'll push us down even more. And then eventually they'll pay nothing. Why should they pay anything? Why should we pay? We're the blessed. We're the ones that God loves and shines favor upon. What are these underlings? They're meant to be ruled by us. They want to go back to that, but the problem is there's too many of us. There's just too many of us. And we'll just smash, I mean, billion versus what, 400? They don't have it. They can't do it. And these cops, I don't know what these cops are thinking. I don't know what they're shooting guys in the face, throwing grenades. They're being the thugs. But even then, they're not going to have it. You know, like, just like you guys, yeah, these Wall Street protests can go on all year. If you think about the amount of people that the 99% really are, and of the people you talk to in your daily day-to-day existence, you know, it's a good thing you gave that $2. That shows a lesson. And maybe, you know, Bubba didn't see it, but maybe his kids saw it. And that'll stay with him for years. And these people are going to be people that are going to think about others, and they're going to be empathetic. That's what we are as Americans, isn't it? I don't know. You know, we won't even teach each other how to shoot guns. Who's a liberal? I won't teach them how to shoot no guns.
I don't want to teach no liberals how to kill people. I just want to teach the side. Yeah, well, would you teach Timothy McVeigh? I mean, I love that from Tom Hartman that he asked him that. Well, I couldn't necessarily tell that Timothy McVeigh wasn't a good Marcon. But, you know, if you got a towel wrapped around your head, I'm pretty sure you ain't.
Oh, Bob, because of your contempt for these types of people, that was such a beautiful inflection of hate. Just right. Just right. I felt that. Oh, God, these people. I don't even know how. Did you see the size of that guy's hat? What the hell is he? What is he, Big Barry Arby's for Halloween? What the hell is that?
That wasn't exactly a tough guy hat, but...
But
when you got a head that big, you need a hat that big.
Goodness gracious, Brother Bob.
I mean, you know, come on. Now, I'm a big guy, but yeah. I can comfortably say to Crockett Keller, buddy, push back from the chicken fried snake once in a while, okay, will you?
Well, the hat was huge. I mean, the hat was even bigger than him. It's crazy.
Well, half of Texas would probably assume he's Mexican just because of the hat.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, who's this guy? Well,
see, that's the whole thing. It's undercover, Albert.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, see, right. He's gonna that way he can sidle into their Mexican communist Obama voting voter fraud conversations and find out what acorns are doing down in the Texas.
God, I'll tell you what. I don't know. God, we have no choice but to vote for Obama, but... Jesus.
Oh, you're going to get pushback on that.
What do you mean?
Oh, I'll get email in a minute. Tell Albert to lay off of Obama. We do, too, have a choice. I'm going to vote for, you know, some third-party candidate.
No, we don't. I wish we did, but we don't. We can't afford it. And I don't care. If we went through 8 years of Bush... We could do 8 years of Obama. Give me a break. It's not even comparable.
Yeah, well, I mean, and see, that's the thing. You know, it's also a question of where are you. For instance, Barack Obama is going to get his ass handed to him in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a consequence of that, you know, maybe for that reason I can say, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to vote for Rufus T. Firefly this year. Because he speaks for me. I'm going to vote my conscience for Rufus T. Firefly.
You don't... We'll see.
If you're in a state where it's, because you know what, I mean, I don't know how to get this reality across, and I do. I get the emails, Albert, and it pisses people off when I say things like this. But let me explain. There are one of two people is going to be president on January the 20th, 2013. It's going to be Barack Obama, or it's going to be Mitt Romney, Perry, Herb Cain. You know, my God, the teabaggers are even telling Michelle Bachmann to get the F out of the race now. It ain't never going to be. You know, the sanest one of the bunch is John Huntsman.
You're making Gonzo angry. Good.
Yeah, well, I see?
You can't talk like that to Gonzo.
I don't want Gonzo angry. But it's, you know, that's who's going to be president January 20th, 2013. You know, it ain't going to be Ralph.
No.
It is not.
I love Ralph.
I do, too.
Yeah.
But I mean, but you get the point. It's not going to be one of those people. And you know, I get these emails about the conscience voting.
We've never had a Republican crowd like as dumb as this one, ever. There's never been so many stupid, dangerous people running for president, ever. I mean, I'd love to give these people the benefit of the doubt, but they're stupid. How stupid are they? They don't make any sense ever.
No, not at all. No. Not even a little bit.
Crazy. They think the world's 5,000 years
old. They walk out on Wednesday and say that it's Sunday. You know,
yeah. No, we can't have that. There's no way. No way. No way. Sorry. I love Ralph. Right. I'm sorry. Continue.
No, but you're saying the same thing.
Yeah. We can't. We can't do that.
But again, we also do, Albert, as I've said before, put ourselves at a degree of risk in focusing so much upon the presidential contest.
True. Oh, yeah.
It's the fight is the Senate.
Mm.
And it's a tougher fight because that's state by state. I mean, look at Nebraska. You know, I keep coming back to Nebraska as the poster child for what's wrong. You know what the choice the Nebraskans are going to get is? They're going to get a choice between the Ben Nelson and that thing on his head.
The Reagan.
Who said that it would be a bad thing for anybody to be able to join a union who wanted to join a union. That's the Democrat. The alternative for Nebraskans will be their present attorney general who says that people who are on public assistance are coons.
You know,
doesn't that just make you want to run screaming naked around the room?
It does, but I have a stick and a knife in my hand, so I'm trying to...
Yeah, I understand.
Dangerous. It's Halloween. You got to scare the kids. But, you know, if we had, just for example, real quick, if we had more people like Dennis Kucinich and, you know, the rest of...
Bernie Sanders,
right? Yeah, but even Barney Frank, you know, there's a bunch of them. We don't have time to name them all. But if we had more of them and they were like that on that side, wouldn't he sort of have to listen to them? But, you see, when we get a Bush in office... Oh, then what happens to Mr. Nebraska? Who does he vote with? Oh, I'm going to have to vote with Bush.
Yeah.
Ms. Lieberman, oh, I'm going to have to vote for Bush. No, I mean, this is what I'm talking about. We need more of those people there to force Obama to do what we really want him to do, because I think, you know, if you don't like his conviction or what have you, that's fine. Then let's get some people in the Senate and the Congress to make him do what we want him to do, because he'll be whatever we want him to be. We just have to put the people in front of him that are going to push him in that direction. So I totally agree.
Indeed.
You know, but then we got Manchin. You got Manchin. He's a Democrat, isn't he?
Yeah, Blanche Manchin.
God. But yeah, I don't know, Brother Bob. I know.
And you know, places like West Virginia or Nebraska, is there any responsibility that falls upon progressive people? I mean, granted, we don't have any money. All we have is the courage of our convictions. And it's hard to get people to show those because these are repressed and oppressed populations. But at some point, do we have any responsibility to acknowledge the basic simple fact that the reason November is going to come down in Nebraska to Ben Nelson or a guy who thinks people on welfare are coons? I mean, you know, those are his words, not mine, okay? I'm not saying that just to be... But,
I know.
Is there no responsibility for us not finding somebody, anybody to cast our ballots for in the primary?
Goodness.
The primaries are what matters. The primaries are what completely determine why the general elections are as screwed up as they are. You know, look at Arkansas this past year. Remember Blanche Lincoln?
Yep.
She got beat in her primary, but wound up in a runoff, and she won the runoff against the progressive person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, she lost in the general election.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get the point. You know, this is one of those perfect little moments, Albert. Breaking news alert from the New York Times. Federal regulators, just based on what you were saying earlier, this is so funny.
Federal regulators have discovered that hundreds of millions of dollars in customer money have gone missing from MF Global in recent days, prompting an investigation into the company's operations as it filed for bankruptcy on Monday, according to several people briefed on the matter. The revelation of the missing money scuttled an 11th-hour deal for MF Global to sell a major part of itself to a rival brokerage firm. MF Global, the powerhouse commodities brokerage run by John S. Corzine, has staked its survival on completing the deal. Now the investigation threatens to tarnish the reputation of Mr. Corzine, the former New Jersey governor and Goldman Sachs chief, who oversaw MF Global's demise, making it the first American victim of Europe's debt crisis. We're sorry, several million dollars have gone missing. What, they grew freaking legs? It isn't missing.
It isn't missing.
It was goddamn stolen.
Yeah, well, see, that's that last line in that sentence, in that story. Europe's debt crisis. You know why Europe has a debt crisis? why don't they ever talk about that? Why does Europe have a debt crisis? Because they bought all the derivative default swaps and all blah, 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 blah. That's why. And that's what the whole problem. That's 80% of it. Ugh, ugh.
I know.
Of course. I don't know.
So you've got trick-or-treaters coming, Albert?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Brother Bob. You?
You got your, yeah, well, you know, they're handling it out front. You know, Mary Janes and caramels. We're not into the expensive candy this year.
Oh, those Mary Janes are delicious.
I love those things, don't you? Yeah, they're better than a bit of honey by a long shot.
Yeah, the bit of honey is too chunky.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Oh, great minds. So, Agnes and the kids are giving out candy, and I guess Ferg's scaring children or something. And I take it you've got the knife and the hockey mask. Is that what I understand?
I've just got the flashlight and the knife, and what are you gonna do? Scare them? Yeah, that's what it's for.
Yeah, you know what? You're just giving them a little ha-ha scare. It's not like you're sitting down on the front stoop and explaining the economy to them. Mama! The bad man! I can't sleep from what the bad man told me!
It's definitely not as scary. In reality, it is a little bit of a scary place. And you're right about, what'd you call that? Can't think. What's his name? See, I can't even talk anymore.
I don't know which what's his name it is.
It's like coming to the show and listening to these horrible things. You were talking about the Greek philosopher.
Oh, Aristotle and catharsis and yeah.
Catharsis, yeah. That's see, I can't think. Sorry, everybody, but sometimes you can't. But
that's okay. That's okay. It took me about 15 minutes to come up with nullification on Friday night, and it made me feel like I was losing my mind. I've been trying to deal with this sick pickup truck I've got. And for the life of me, most times when I'm trying to remember torque converter, all I can think of is transfer case. And it's like, no, that's not it.
That's not the tool.
But whatever it is, I can't afford to replace any of them. So, to hell with me, right?
Well, that's exactly. It's like that beautiful commercial, because I can hear the dummy screaming and you play it, about West Virginia's most abundant natural resource, and I can just hear people do, yep, damn it, coal. I can just hear anybody say that because if you ask them, but wind, duh, oh yeah, that's right. Every day it blows, it keeps blowing and blowing and blowing.
I know because I chase my shingles out into the yard every time we have a good wind.
I mean, come on, just one little word could change everything. Get people to start realizing and thinking bigger, and we'll be all right. We'll be all right.
All right. Have yourself a happy Halloween, and I hope the girls are having a happy one too, Albert.
Always, Brother Bob. You be good.
All right.
My love to everybody.
Sure thing.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Brother Albert, the sage of southwest Wisconsin. Hey, welcome to the program. Well, hey, Susan, what's up?
There's going to be for me, the stuff hasn't really started yet. My stuff starts after moonrise.
You're out. Do you have clear skies for moonrise tonight?
Well, it doesn't matter.
You don't have to see it to know it's risen. Yeah, that is one of those science things, isn't it?
Yeah. It's,
we'll take moonrise as red.
Yeah, as it being so, and I don't need, I'm not going to be, well, but in any case, I don't do skyclad, so I'm not going to be out there doing my thing.
Right, I understand.
Man's clothes. So it's going to be an all.
Discretion is the better part of valor.
Yeah. But it, for me, it's a religious holiday. It's but it's fun listening to the other people describe it because I've heard a lot of people say over the years, well, isn't Halloween offensive? And I'm going, actually, no, I've always been rather amused by it.
It's a children's holiday.
Yeah. It's a reason for the kiddies to dress up in silly costumes. Although my son, he tended more towards the macabre. He insisted I make him up as a newly dug up corpse, murdered corpse every year.
Oh, fun.
It had been had its throat cut. I don't know why the kid was strange from the day he was born. But, and he, they would go out, he and his sister would go out and just have a blast.
You know, I'd just like to dress up tonight as a guy who can drink a beer without his entire guts going sideways, but I guess I'm out on that, too.
Well, I don't know how... Well, I suppose you could dress up as a Pastafarian.
But you got the photo I sent you for the post, right?
It's in the post.
Well, I haven't been able to go and see, so, yeah, that's... Actually, that wasn't even a costume. That was me walking. I had to go up to the school and take Doodle some ibuprofen earlier today. And I had my pea coat on with the collar turned up. And I walked in the door, and the cat, who was in the photograph, literally climbed me to get up on my shoulder.
I had a cat at one time.
And nothing was after her, by the way.
His name was BC. He was a Persian cat, black Persian cat. And he had those great big bones, you know, huge bones. And big, big, almost coppery red eyes. And what he would do, Donald and I were living in this kind of trailer park thing. And it was behind this motel that his son was managing. And he was the motel cat. And what he would do is he'd sit up there on the window units of these in this motel, waiting for people to walk by. And every time they did, out would come this big, hairy old paw, and he'd whack him right up. Anyway, I wanted to expand a little on what the other caller from Portland. God, don't you just love Portlanders? Was saying, if you read a little science fiction, sooner or later you're going to hit Robert Heinlein. And he wrote a juvenile way many, many moons ago called Time for the Stars.
Yep, I remember it.
Okay, one of the main deals in there was a research organization whose motto was Bread Cast Upon the Waters. And basically, their whole thing was they had these huge endowments, and what they would do is they would take money and dump it down these incredibly impractical sounding rat holes that invariably turned out making them huge amounts of money. Sound familiar? And so, of course, they decide, here's a rat hole we can dump money down for years. It's called faster than light travel. Needless to say, guess what happens?
Right.
Thereby making them even more money. The government just can't seem to get it through their head. And these research organizations just can't seem to get it through their heads. It's research for research's sake for you. It's the accidental discoveries. How much money has 3M made off of Post-it notes?
you know, why is it Post-it notes are what always comes to mind? Because it did for me too, Susan.
How much money was made off of the microwave oven that was accidental? They were trying for something else entirely, and a guy noticed, hey, wait a minute, this just cooked my this piece of lunch meat really, really
right.
Well done. How much money was made off of that patent?
No small pocket change, I'm reckoning.
Don't you just wish. How much money was, you know, and all of these are just utterly accidental byproducts of some other type of research. And all of a sudden, wham, you have these huge income streams and industries that are branching off one side up, one side down the other. And it's just amazing. And it always happens. It never fails. Now, here is a little goodie. Also from this, by the way, I love the things you're doing from Paul. Just to change the mood a little, I have changed my sig line.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there you are. Progress is like a herd of pigs. The herd brings many benefits, but no one should wonder at all the poop.
Yep. It's true. I have to give credit where credit's due. I did not write that. I lifted it whole from a video game. Credit to CD Projekt Red and their game The Witcher.
Okay.
But you have to admit, it's true.
Oh, it very much is. That my other favorite pig analogy is never wrestle with a pig in poop. You both get covered with poop, and the pig enjoys it. Yeah, that applies to arguing with right wingers. That's why they're not allowed on this program.
Oh yeah, I know. It's just a pain in the ass. The only person I've ever managed to see, very few people that I've ever run across on the radio can manage to handle right-wingers.
Well, the only way to handle a right-winger is to tell them to move along and go use somebody else's airtime. I want to be abundantly clear on this, Susan, and I'm not barking at you. There is nothing to be gained. You know, it is that phrase. There is nothing to be gained from arguing with a right-winger. Because they are not going to come around. They just are not.
I never expect a right winger to come around.
It's the whole thing where, you know, they say, it was described. You know, you show them the data and, well, you know, that's not real. And now I'm sure out there on some right-wing message board somewhere, some bunch of hopping up and down little knuckle walkers are screaming about the betrayal by Richard Mueller. He's been bought off. You know, it's like the hotel in Nashville that refused to host that anti-Islamic hate fest, and the response from Frank Gaffney was, "This hotel apparently now operates under Sharia law."
Can somebody explain to me why the closest thing we have in this country to Sharia law is coming out of the Southern Baptist Convention?
There! See, the reason they hate Sharia law is they don't want anything competing with theirs.
I'm sorry, but they want a theocracy
and they don't want any competition because the fact of the matter is their religion can't compete. You know, the very fact that they, and it's the Southern Baptist Church that commissioned the data. They have data now that tells them that the minute that a child gets away from one of their hate-filled little churches,
They never come back. You know, I'm one of them.
You blame them? I don't.
You know, even Ferg, you know, he had his dalliance with the Baptists. And wants nothing to do with them now. Because it didn't take long for him to see them for what they were.
My father's family came out of the Mormons.
Right, it's the same principle.
Mormon help. Oh, thank you very much. Not gonna have anything to. I read a whole bunch about it. Not gonna. No, don't want it. You keep it.
Exactly.
You invented it. You may have it with my blessing. Talk to me about it.
Indeed. Well, Susan, have yourself a very happy holy day. I hope you will come moonrise. And we'll be thinking of others for whom this is a very sacred day. And
how is Agnes doing?
She ain't feeling good at all, but she's got a doctor's appointment tomorrow, so cross your fingers.
I shall be sending all sorts of good stuff towards her. And if necessary, I'll resurrect the ancestors.
Indeed, indeed. Susan, take care and have a wonderful evening.
Give my love to everybody.
Sure will.
Blessed be.
You too.
Everyone.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
News Ninja Susan calling from Oregon. And, yeah, it's Halloween, so we will mark that with another little piece here, if that's okay by you. Fairly well-known, but it has the air of madness to it that I so like. Another little bit of Poe. I guess Edgar Allan Poe is kind of the patron saint of Halloween, isn't he? Hear the sledges with the bells. Silver bells. What a world of merriment their melody foretells, how they tinkle, tinkle, tinkle in the icy air of night, while the stars that oversprinkle all the heavens seem to twinkle with a crystalline delight, keeping time, time, time in a sort of runic rhyme to the tintinnabulation that so musically wells from the bells. Bells, 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 from the jingling and the tinkling of the bells. Hear the mellow wedding bells, golden bells. What a world of happiness their harmony foretells. Through the balmy air of night, how they ring out their delight. From the molten golden notes and all in tune, what a liquid ditty floats to the turtle dove that listens while she gloats on the moon. Oh, from out the sounding cells, what a gush of euphony voluminously wells. How it swells, how it dwells on the future, how it tells of the rapture that impels to the swinging and the ringing of the bells, bells, bells. Of the bells, 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 bells. To the rhyming and the chiming of the bells. Hear the loud alarum bells, brazen bells. What tale of terror now their turbulency tells in the startled ear of night, how they scream out their affright, too much horrified to speak. They can only shriek, shriek out of tune in a clamorous appealing to the mercy of the fire, in a mad expostulation with the deaf and frantic fire, leaping higher, higher, higher with a desperate desire and a resolute endeavor now, now to sit or never by the side of the pale-faced moon. Oh, the bells, bells, bells. What a tale their terror tells of despair. How they clang and clash and roar. What a horror they outpour on the bosom of the palpitating air. Yet the ear, it fully knows by the twanging and the clanging how the danger ebbs and flows.
Yet the ear distinctly tells in the jangling and the wrangling how the danger sinks and swells by the sinking or the swelling and the anger of the bells. Of the bells. 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 In the clamor and the clangor of the bells. Hear the tolling of the bells. Iron bells. What a world of solemn thought their monody compels. In the silence of the night, how we shiver with affright at the melancholy meaning of their tone. For every sound that floats from the rust within their throats is a groan. And the people, the people that dwell up in the steeple all alone and who, tolling, tolling, tolling in that muffled monotone, feel a glory in so rolling on the human heart a stone. They are neither man nor woman. They are neither brute nor human. They are ghouls. And their king it is who tolls. And he rolls, 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 rolls a paean from the bells. And his merry bosom swells with the paean of the bells. And he dances and he yells, keeping time. Time, time, in a sort of runic rhyme to the paean of the bells, keeping time, 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 in a sort of runic rhyme to the throbbing of the bells, 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 to the sobbing of the bells. Keeping time, 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 as he knells, 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 in a happy runic rhyme to the rolling of the bells, 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 to the tolling of the bells, 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 bells. Bells, 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 to the moaning and the groaning of the bells.
This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
And your thoughts won't fit together. to the Head On Halloween Special with your host, Bob Kincaid. Mwahahaha.
The vocal stylings of horn intern junior grade Ferg. 19 minutes past the hour. This is Halloween on the Horn. It's also Moran Monday, which works out rather conveniently, really, when you think about it. This email in from Andy in California. I told you wouldn't get away with it, Albert. Andy saying, concerning Albert's comments on Mr. Obama, you think I'm going to let it go by? No, Andy, I didn't. Mr. Bob, yes, if we don't support or vote for Mr. Obama, then the great tragedy is we may get the real fascists, the true men or women representing the top 1%. Make no bones about it, we get the real deal. Instead, if we support Mr. Obama, then we get the bright, smiling face of the Milton Friedman Chicago School, the pseudo-fascist in form with sugar-coated rhetoric. I'd rather have the real deal because in a few years, when the union comes apart at the seams and the rubber bullets and police beanbags start to fly, I want to take a crack at bringing down the real deal, the true fascist leaders representing the plutocracy. It just wouldn't be too much fun bringing down a government that has no conviction, but instead is chock full of craven cowards, lacking full conviction representing the top 1%. Let's have the real fascists in office so we can crush them. Remember, Bob, focus, Albert, on electing Representative Tammy Baldwin to the Senate. Forget about Mr. Obama. Forget about him. His Wall Street friends will take care of his election. It's a done deal. And I often do think that it's a done deal because it's hard to look at the Repig-Lickin' field and feel like they're really mounting a serious challenge. Although the American people can be surprisingly stupid in their electoral choices. I mean, we already know how Crockett Keller is going to vote, right? I mean, even if the nominee were to be Herb Cain. By the way, speaking of Herb Cain, Michael, Kid A from the chat room, also wrote back in. He said, Herb Cain, who put this pubic hair on my pizza? Herb Cain, would you like to try one of Godfather's Long Dong breadsticks? Yeah. And by the way, Michael says, I'd just like to remind everyone that 1% of the tricksters have 99% of the treats. Hashtag Occupy Halloween. Yeah, indeed. So Michael sent along a couple of tracks. We'll try to get to those before the evening's out, with any luck at all. Let's go forward to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Happy Halloween. It's Mark.
Hey, Mark. How you doing? Thank you. Happy Halloween to you.
Thanks, brother. The one comment from the individual that said, let's let this catastrophe fall for real. That way we can make real progress by taking on the true fascists. There's a part of me that I kind of like that challenge. I'm only 53, but I'm still in pretty good shape, and I don't know which philosopher it was, but they say you can judge a man to some degree by the strength of his back and the strength of his hands. I try to keep those in some decent shape. I can still crush somebody with my fist, even though I have a high-pitched voice. But
I don't think it's that high-pitched.
Tell Republicans, you know, I said at least we. When we fight wars, we don't lose them, and they really don't like that. But I'm a good-sized guy, so they really – I'm kind of intimidating when I zero in on you, and it really messes them up. There's a handful of Christian right-wingers that are extremists that associate themselves with organized labor, and I did this in the Marine Corps when I was in, Bob. I tried to ferret out the weak links in the chain, I did it not so ostentatiously, but at times there's ways you can put peer pressure on men, as you know and guess, and it forces them to step up or step out or in last night's show, step back. But earlier, when Davy Crockett's grandson was advertising for his gun thing, it kind of got my lack of masculinity cord going. So I thought, you know, it's funny about guns. Apparently there's 300 million guns in this great free country of ours. I don't know how many Brazil has, but they hate us for our freedom. And I got to thinking that the short time I spent as a city Miami policeman, and the short time I spent as a United States Marine guarding embassies in Central and South America in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, there were many displays of how quickly you would be shot as a person approaches with a weapon with their finger already on the trigger versus your finger on the side of the housing group where your finger is not on the trigger, and just that little difference of time. And, of course, I would guess a person like yourself, obviously, and some of your listeners would realize that most shootings take place at 5 to 7 feet, and they're usually sympathetic shootings, both people getting shot. But it really is racism, what that ad is not racist in its what it's saying, though it can be interpreted that way. But really, guns are kind of, to me, kind of like the yellow code, the green code, wrap your house in plastic, go shopping at the mall, be scared of a guy in a cave that we financed. It's just a fear, and now they're drumming up the Iran thing the best they can. It's kind of a weak attempt, but I it's not why I called the show. I wanted to make a couple comments about that, the gun aspect of our sweet society. But one of my friends at work, a couple of my friends, mentioned the Iran thing, and I would just make a comment to anybody that's listening that Iran would pose a bit of a conventional threat, not just it wouldn't be in Iraq where the city and the wheels fell off and there were a lot of
No, we have no idea, Mark, what we'd be facing if we tried to attack Iran conventionally.
I was at the Los Angeles Book Festival when I worked out at San Onofre, and actually Chris Hedges was one of the speakers. I got lucky enough to catch him. I think I went up and shook his hand afterwards, and like yourself, I think we both admire the things that he stands for, and his background might be similar to your own in some degrees, Bob. And in any case, there was an Iranian, I think he was a doctor, well-dressed guy, that spoke and in the audience, and he said, you know, he was a person that made a living here in the United States, a successful one, and he said, if you Americans do attack Iran, you know, and every time that McCain or Bush would threaten Iran, you would see the oil prices would jump up in this.
Right, which was the sole purpose of it.
That's probably right, but unfortunately, the poor folks in Iran don't have that. They don't have that opportunity to think so ridiculously. And I did hear an interesting connection, which I was slightly aware of, not totally, but that there's the connection between Saudi Arabia's folks and something to do in Iran. They're kind of doing their dirty work for somebody themselves or whatever. I don't know the connection, but, and of course, the security apparatus for the Iranians, the Savak, which, you know, anyway, but the goes back to that. But he made a comment that wouldn't surprise you or any of the listeners, but basically, if you attack Iran, that me, a right-wing Christian Iranian Los Angeles Republican doctor will go back to Iran and we will oppose you physically. All of us will pull together and then we'll sort out our differences. That would be really no different than probably parts of West Virginia or anywhere else in the world, you know. And that's, you know, it took the Vietnamese about 500 years to get the Chinese to go home from that war. And I guess we thought, of course, Henry Kissinger probably never been in a fist fight, but they wouldn't know nor care. But I make the comparison when you brought up Silly Putty, that according to Daniel Yergin's book, the prize about, concerning oil, that the Americans bombed a synthetic oil producing facility in Germany over 3,000 times during World War II. They wanted to make sure that the world ran off of Fins oil, which the Marines.
Yeah, was that Ploesti?
Name of the company, Bob? Is that
No. The name of the location. Yeah, I think that was that the Ploesti fields in Romania.
Let's see if I remember correctly. They actually have photographs in the book, Bob. And
it really, you know, we don't have to get that detail oriented, but I think that's what we're describing. Because we just bombed the snot out of it because crippling their means of fueling the Wehrmacht had a big part to play in keeping, well, in ultimately winning the war. But it was brutal. If I recall correctly, we lost tremendous amounts of flyers in the raid over Plo SC. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, our own people, but, you know, I can't speak to the what you're describing specifically, but apparently there are photographs of a before and after picture of the synthetic fuel factory there. That kind of gets back to, you know, when the Marines, after their photo shoot at Da Nang in 65, I've read accounts and Rumor of War by Philip Caputo, and I don't know where else along the line I've caught that and talked to actual Marine veterans from Vietnam, that fire teams would be assigned, or squads assigned, an actual banyan tree. I think it was broke down by fire team. This fire team, which consists of four Marines, there's three fire teams in a squad. Each fire team would be given a particular banyan tree, which were, of course, ran by Michelin. And of course, it's synthetic rubber now, like you said. And I also draw in the connection that I talked to some of my right-wing gun people at work, and I said, you know, they can turn that dial up or down on synthetic gunpowder now. So whatever you know, country boy can, you know, survive. I mean, not only will the deer and the fish kill you with the BCBs, but you're going to go out and shoot something that has a shelf life of a year, and you've waited 18 months, and you're not going to get much, you know, out of the end of your weapon, so to speak. But it's amazing how well controlled and how, you know, and then I'll go, you know, and then you get the mentality, well, I'll go get the rock salt and this and that. And then it's just like the crystal meth business, you know, where the Walgreens and the Walmarts track the different ingredients. So it would take no time at all to shut down all the country boy can survive mentality. It just shows.
To go back, Mark, just a little ways into to the origins of the conversation, you mentioned, well, let me just say that I kind of, as I see more of this nullification frenzy taking over Jesus land, it is difficult for me. I mean, I understand better than ever, I think, the absolute dogged determination that Abraham Lincoln had to keep the Union together. I understand it on a visceral level. And I don't want violent revolution.
I don't either.
I don't seek it. I don't want to encourage it. And so when our buddy Andy talks about, you know, wanting to crush the fascists and getting a crack in at them, you know, there's never going to be a time in the United States when we can do that, because they will get the licks in first. Anyone, for instance, who saw the story coming out of Nashville over the weekend about the writer for their alternative paper called The Scene, this guy went down to occupy Nashville on the state capitol grounds, which falls under the aegis of the Tennessee Highway Patrol and not the local Nashville PD, and actually got audio of the arrest. And these guys were, you know, these Tennessee Highway Patrolmen were behaving like jackbooted thugs. And they were acting on the orders of Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam. And there are, you know, the thing about fascists is they will crack skulls and ask questions later. And I think you know that, Mark.
Well,
and so, you know, getting a bunch of people together who are liberal or progressive and talking them into violent revolution, I'm just, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm like the Beatles, you know. I'm not. They caught a bunch of crap for the lyrics to their song, and I can't get down with it. I understand that we are in a period of empire. And that informs a lot of what I say and a lot of how I think. All these actions must be peaceably intended, because the minute that anything even remotely resembles violence happens, it will be crushed. And that's part of the reason that the New York Police Department, for instance, are funneling all the unhinged and profoundly intoxicated homeless into Zuccotti Park. Because they know that they'll cause problems, and once they cause problems, they will crush, or hope to crush, what's going on at Occupy Wall Street. You know, one of the occupiers complained to the police about a profoundly disturbed individual singing at the top of his lungs at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the cop's response was,
Well, you're here to exercise your right to free speech, and he's got one too, so deal with it. These are the tactics of fascistically oriented organizations.
I agree, Bob. Can I ask you? And I agree. I guess I just speak to you as a fellow American in our age group. Is that if there was some type of catastrophic clash, which I don't wish upon us, I totally agree with your interpretation on it. And we are very close in our perceptions of how to deal with it, because they will be put down preemptively and dramatically. And actually, they kind of are. I was going to get your clarification though on the. Did I not read or hear that the situation in Nashville where a judge, is that the case?
The thing is, they arrest him, and then the magistrate throws out all the charges.
Okay, so well, what do you make of that? I mean, is that just?
Well, I think that the magistrate is attempting to follow the law.
Oh, okay, well, that's the way I would look at it from a constitutional standpoint. So,
because the magistrate is held to a different standard than a cop. What I mean by that is the magistrate is held to canons of judicial ethics that apply to judges, magistrates, what have you. Common pleas court, I think, is what it's called in Tennessee. And they're held to judicial ethics that don't necessarily obtain with the police. So and what will ultimately happen is the taxpayers of Tennessee, via the insurance that they pay for, will wind up paying massive settlements to these people who have been harassed by the police in Tennessee without legal justification for so doing.
So, in other words, from various aspects, it's wise to be conducting himself in that way. That's the way are you taking it that way?
Yeah. The magistrate is doing the right thing. The governor, Bill Haslam, is, because Democrat or Republican, you can't say anything in the Deep South without having, because we're fiscally conservative. Well, it is not fiscally conservative to put yourself in risk, to put your state government in risk management situations that are going to cost you a fortune. You know, I remember here in West Virginia, Mark, back during the days of George W. administration, they had what was termed a 4th of July rally down at the Capitol grounds in Charleston. And George W. came and he pontificated and talked about, we're fighting for Jesus, whatever it was.
Sure.
And a couple of people simply had T-shirts on that were anti-Bush. They weren't saying anything. They weren't marching. They weren't carrying signs. They weren't protesting. They weren't peeing on the grounds. They weren't doing anything except being.
It was a guy and a girl, weren't they, Bob?
Yeah, the husband and wife, I believe, or boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. But they worked together, and they were arrested. They were charged. They were dragged off the grounds, and the state of West Virginia wound up, in addition to having, since it wasn't an official, so-called official campaign function, the taxpayers of the state of West Virginia were on the hook for the whole shebang. And on top of it, we wound up being on the hook for the legal settlement that we had to pay to those two people who should never have been abused in the first place. And the same thing will likely happen all over the United States because of the heavy-handed, ham-fisted tactics of the police.
Well, can I also make an observation, which I would guess that you would already cross your mind, but... I haven't had a chance, just because of my work schedule. I'm kind of out of town from the Ocala area, which hosts two right-wing shows of no surprise, which I've mentioned one of them to you. One of them has, just to remind anybody listening from the FM station, has a broadcast signal that you could pick up from Lake City, Florida, right basically at the Georgia border all the way to Orlando. That's quite a distance. And that's the one that works right with Neil Bortz and also supported the fair tax. And it's a modern-day phenomenon. It's been put there intentionally, and I've called that show from the very beginning and given them shit. And when the hurricanes passed through, just on a side note, one of the little right-wing afternoon talk show hosts, whose father, he's against big government, but his father was a deadbeat Army soldier who didn't do shit in the Army as a combatant, but liked all the benefits because I don't know how many people with all these Air Force and Army stickers on their vehicles retired, and they're all against big government. I'm like, well, you are the big government. But in any case, he made the mistake, Bob, after the hurricane, one of the hurricanes passed through that made it that far inland. had broken a number of the windows at the radio station, and they had big sheets of the plywood just wrapped completely around it. And they said, if you want to come down and just say anything on these sheets of plywood, you may. And I think by the time I left, I'd counted over 40 W's with the slash through it. And my first one was just a big, huge one, as big as I can reach my arms. And actually, he got so pissed, he called the police. He walked out on a cigarette break, and a policeman pulled up, and he flagged him down, and then he tried to complain about me. And I said, that's the disc jockey officer. And I said, he's the one that invited the listeners here. And the cop looked at him, and he goes, did you say that? And he said, yeah, I guess I did. The disc jockey cussed me. I was like, and I've been fighting these people ever since, but I thought that you might appreciate that these policemen, no matter whether in Oakland or wherever they may be, are they not bright enough to realize these heavy-handed tactics, no matter who they're responding to, whether it's Rahm Emanuel or the Republican in Tennessee, that they themselves are being corporatized and put out of business and laid off?
When they're all done up in their riot gear, though, Mark, you can't get a badge number, you can't get a name, their faces are hidden behind shields, so you can't really get a good look so they are completely anonymized, and therefore any liability that attaches to the department and the government, and therefore they are rendered effectively or constructively immune.
Well, I can pick up on that, and I understand that concept, but my observation would be, Bob, that just the fact that they themselves, you're looking at areas where the tax base isn't strong enough, and they're having to lay off, whole police departments or half of police departments. In other words, so in the court of public opinion, from a citizen standpoint, which, we used to be citizens, but now we're consumer people. Go to the mall, wrap your house in plastic, but be scared. That, in other words, if anybody's paying attention, would it not be unwise to be heavy-handed and to actually kind of be more communicative?
It is wholly unwise, but you're also dealing with an authoritarian structure, Mark, and it's order given, order followed. I mean, I think you can probably identify with that.
Unfortunately.
The other thing that plays into this, I think I mentioned it last week sometime, is the constant rebranding that's going on via Karl Rove. For instance, if you tell people that without the Obama administration's plans to infuse capital into state governments and county and local governments, that police, firefighters, and teachers will be laid off, the people say, oh, hell no. But if you rebrand it under Rovian tactics and you say union workers will be laid off, people go, well, hell yeah, that's what I want. So, there is so much cognitive dissonance and so much disconnect going on that is deliberately, that static, that cognitive dissonance is deliberately created. And as a consequence, even the cops, I think, find it hard to stand up against it. So, for what it's worth, Mark, it's awfully good hearing from you, brother. You have yourself a good night and a happy Halloween, okay?
Bob, I was just going to mention, if you had, thank you very much, and I appreciate you. I'm just going to mention there was a man on Democracy Now, if you didn't catch it, the Brian Wilson story. Did you catch that blood on the train, blood on the tracks?
No, I did not.
It's an astounding story of a Vietnam veteran, an Air Force captain, that goes out and assesses the bomb destruction of the B-52s and finds large amounts of dead women and children in Vietnam, and how it changed him profoundly, and how he takes on Reagan in 87 by trying to stop the three-mile run from the California post where they were delivering military equipment to the port, which would float right down to probably Honduras under John Negroponte.
So or El Salvador, right.
Right. Well, this Vietnam veteran stayed on the railroad tracks and was ran over, and it cut both of his legs off. He's got a book called Blood on the Tracks. Amy had him on there for the hour, and he's going around to the Occupy Wall Street crowds, and he's quite a neat guy. I think you.
I'll have to check it out. And of course, you mentioned John Negroponte. Of course, his partner in crime, Elliot Abrams. You may remember him. I don't know if you realize it, but Elliot Abrams' wife has been out running her mouth. She's one of these hyper-vocal, all Arabs are scum, Muslims must die types.
Oh, that's always good. Yeah.
And Elliot Abrams' wife has recently suggested that Arabs and Palestinians, that Israelis should feed Arabs and Palestinians to the sharks, and recently told a reporter that she would like to have him fed to the sharks as well. So, you know, the scum never stops being scum. Mark, it's good to hear from you, brother. Take care. Bye now. Mark calling from Florida. Email in from Andy. He says, that's an interesting development that the homeless are being directed to Zuccotti Park, because in Oakland, the day before the big police raid, city social workers came down to the camp and removed the homeless and deranged folks. This could be a good weather vane for the Occupy Wall Street people. Once the homeless are removed, you can expect a police raid. The homeless and the deranged will gravitate to free food and shelter even without police coaxing. And there's an element of truth to that. They will gravitate without being told. But by the same token, the fact that they're being actively shepherded into Zuccotti Park, that smacks of an overt tactic to me. And, of course, if you've watched carefully, if you've watched the video of Scott Olson being shot down, it becomes abundantly obvious that the policeman in question who shot him was aiming for him, aiming at him. And more than one person who was witness to that horror has noted the fact. It wasn't just a random shot. He was aiming at Scott Olson, who was, at the time, by the way, clutching a copy of the Constitution. Yeah, nice, huh? Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, listen, so I don't know if you heard this, but I guess the Greek who can't speak English is running Greece. Is throwing in the towel, dude, because he just announced that they're going to put this new deal to a referendum.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because that's going to pass.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a huge announcement. I was like, what? Because you think that people are going to okay that? I don't think so. And so the thing that's really interesting about...
Oh, no. Lost Sandra. I hadn't heard that. No way the people, no way the Greek people are going to willingly slit their own throats. Unless, of course, do they have video game voting in Greece? I think that's a fair question. Well, let's keep rolling and maybe Sandra will call back. Maybe that's her now. Hey, is that Sandra?
Yeah, was that me or you?
No, that was you.
I was on. Anyway,
NSA, it is, after all, Halloween, and they can play tricks, too.
Well, see, the big thing that I was wondering about when the deal first came out, I'm like, okay, if someone's taking a 50% haircut, I'm wondering how come they didn't have a, quote, credit event and the default swaps didn't kick in. You see what I'm saying? So now they're just making up shit. It's like, if you all, not to say that credit default swaps are good, but the idea is that you buy these things to insure something. And if it goes bad, you're supposed to kick in. You're supposed to get paid, right?
Right, because they are insured, correct?
Right, but they basically said, well, no, it's volunteer, so it didn't trigger it. So that's why you saw today the markets were fucked up, if you noticed, right? Because this thing stinks to the high heavens. And the BRIC countries who they're holding their hat in hand out are, like, saying no. And Japan, also, they're cold about giving money to this sort of fake vehicle they created to leverage their bailout fund.
And okay, and I read something the other day, Sandra, that said the Europeans are asking the Chinese to capitalize their problems.
Today it was reported that, you know, they're not too keen on it, or the Japanese. So with this Greek referendum, I mean, you know, shit ain't looking, that's looking really bad because, you know, if they have a credit event, you know, we're talking Lehman times four, who knows?
Yeah, meltdown status. And that's the question I was asking as you were calling back. Do the Greek people, do they actually vote with paper ballots, or do they have video game voting, or do we know?
Oh, I don't know. don't know, but they will vote no against it. I mean, the thing is, this is a smart move for Papandreou to do, because he has to have some sort of political accountability now. It's total social unrest, and it's like, as a politician, you know, he has to do something. So if he throws it out there, whatever the decision is provides him with political cover, because he's looking at civil war and straight up social unrest, okay, nonstop 24 hours a day. So as far as a move, I mean, I can't say I blame him, but there's a good chance that it's going to not pass. So that's when, you know, other things might happen. And, you know, you need to keep your eye out on Italy, because their yields went over 6% today, which, you know, that's a problem. And the bond auction they sold, the bank there, the European bank, they had to scale that back a bit. So basically, everything is a confidence game, and there ain't no confidence, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I had a note earlier from Reverbo today, Sandra, who sent me some writing from a guy who writes, I guess, for an Indian news outlet now that Reverbo knows. And the guy's writing, he says, my reasons for believing the Wall Street rally is temporary are as follows. And there's this line. The Europeans have been solving. I love the way he put this. The Europeans have been solving the Greek issues since February of 2010. This one will not fix anything. So
no, it's a problem. I mean, a lot of it is like smoke and mirrors, and you're looking at like the confidence of the Troika, which is, I guess, the European Central Bank and the IMF. And I can't remember who else.
You know, and the thing I keep coming up with just in general terms, Sandra, is that we only think it's been bad. We haven't seen it. Is that fair to assert that there is a combination of events that is that yet lies in the future that will make everything from 2008 to the present look not nearly as bad as we thought it was?
Well, if you look at, I mean, if you want to pair, I'm always paralleling with some of the events in the, you know, around the Great Depression, and you had, I can't pronounce the name of the bank, no German, but the Austrian bank in 1931 that collapsed. So that, you know, really brought on the Great Depression in the form that, you know, you and I are familiar with. You know what I mean? So you had it sort of bumping along at the bottom like it's been doing since the first crash in 2008. Now, if this European shit rolls over, you know, it's bad. You heard about that MP Global, which is a wonderful name.
Well, MF Global, which is even funnier.
Global,
yeah.
I mean. Okay, so did you hear that they also, oopsie, like $700 of customers' money seemed to have disappeared?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it was there yesterday.
Well, now it ain't there. And it's just kind of like they were totally exposed to whatever sort of European map. Hello?
Yeah, you're there.
Oh, I use this phone. Anyway, yeah, so... Anyway, I don't know, but the whole thing is beyond disturbing, and I don't know. I'm not too sure. You know, I don't have no predictions about
it. Well, and what they say way down at the bottom of this initial MF Global story is that regulators are examining whether MF Global diverted some customer money to support its own trades as the firm teetered on the brink of collapse.
Right. That's what I mean. What else is new? And it's just kind of like,
I mean, does anybody, that, you know what? If nobody goes to jail out of that, nobody ever goes to jail.
Well, no, nobody ever goes to jail. And, you know, it's just, I don't know.
It's like that thing on 60 Minutes last night with Madoff's son and Madoff's wife sitting there sort of moaning into the camera. I don't know if you caught that or not.
No, I don't.
No, we tried to commit suicide. Oh,
that's
don't
supposed
you
to do what?
Yeah, don't you feel bad for us? See?
No, I think of the Roman method. Go that route, motherfuckers.
Yeah, just get right, and you know that's honorable at least.
Go that. You know, I mean, I'm not even hearing it about him. Or I like to see people jump out windows. I don't really care. You see what I'm saying? It's well beyond that.
Yeah, and you know, we passed the anniversary just this past Saturday, you know, October 29th, you know, of the 1929 crash. And what you just pointed out with the collapse of that Austrian bank, we have this sort of compression of history thing that goes on, Sandra, where we, you know, we just assume the stock market crashed in 1929 and everything fell apart.
No, that's what I'm saying. You had years of bumping along, like what we had with this madness in 2008. And the thing about it is, it's, you know, the bubbles, they behave the same damn way from John Law's Mississippi scheme to this bullshit today. And it's amazing. It just keeps happening. That's
and,
the thing.
But I mean,
that's
but
incredible.
But in light of what happened between 1929 and, say, 1939, are there enough differences, Sandra, that we kind of, if we're living in the reality-based world, that we have to expect, or that we have to say, if no one else will, that, listen, these people have gotten to a point where they can't fix what they've broken?
Well, the Europe thing is certainly looking not fixable, and it's not in the best interest of these countries that have been told that they're in debt to continue on with this bullshit, which is why it's interesting about the Greek move today.
So what happens? I mean, if it all falls apart, do they all just recapitalize their own currencies?
Well, the countries that leave will just, I'm sure they have their currency, I'm sure they have the drachma ready to go. And you don't think that Portugal and Ireland would be like, well, shit, I'm out. Why wouldn't they? But the worry is I think Italy has like some sort of what, $1.8 trillion in public debt? That one is too big to fail and too big to bail?
Yeah, I caught the remark, I think it was Monday night last, of Silvio Berlusconi moaning and groaning that Angela Merkel and perhaps Sarkozy had treated him like a child. Was that the phrase I read?
Well, the thing, he got bigger worries than that, because if you know anything about the Italian political system, it's completely chaotic and frightening, because I don't know what terrorist group is called, what is it called, the one of the red somebodies, but they're now talking about effing with some of their labor law. People died behind them fucking with that in 99. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They assassinated folks behind them messing with the labor situation in Italy. That ain't no joke there. So, hey, political violence, you know, the whole nine yards. We're talking Europe. We're now talking Europe without any control.
And see, that's one of the things that scares me, Sandra, because I'm in the middle, you know, I was telling Jim last week, I'm in the middle of rereading Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August.
All right, okay.
And I recommend it to anybody who is interested, because we are smack dab in the middle of the 100th anniversary of all the crap that led up to August of 1914, which, of course, changed the face of the planet forever.
Yeah, well, I mean, we seem to be, you know, kind of swirling in that kind of continuum right now, where some little event like that, you see what I'm saying? Because we're not just looking at something isolated anymore, because as it was then, we're globalized, you know?
Yeah, and it was, what's his name, the famous German from the late 19th century, said that the next horror would be triggered by what he called some damn thing in the Balkans, which, of course, it turned out to be.
Are we talking about Wilhelm Kaiser?
No, not Kaiser Wilhelm, the smart one. It's not Hindenburg. Jim would know it. Dadgummit. Same guy that said the whole of the Balkans is not worth the bones of one Pomeranian grenadier.
But the thing is,
we have schooled ourselves for the last 70 years on the idea that after World War II, that Europe would not study war no more. And
well, that's until they thought that this sort of fiscal union would work, and it's not working. So
yeah, Bismarck, by the way. Thank you, Marty.
Bismarck. Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, some damn thing in the Peloponnese. You know, because if Greece turns this referendum down and crap blows up, would anybody be surprised to see boots marching through Athens?
Well, no, you know, and don't forget that Cyprus, ain't nobody talking about that, but they basically have imploded. That's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, economically, it's probably.
And the Flemish the Flemish and the Walloons or the Walloons and whomever in Belgium.
Oh yeah, that's a mess.
They're having conversations about whether they want to be Belgium anymore.
Oh no, I mean they nationalized their BS bank. Yeah, no, it's I don't like I said it's just sort of chit chat we're having, but I just thought, wow, this shit is jumping off. I guess it's time to go.
But, yeah, got to get out of here,
Herman Cain.
Yeah, Herb, you want a Coke with that, Herb?
Oh, God. Anyway, have a good evening.
All right, see you. Happy Halloween. Bye now. I hope Sandra's nieces have a wonderful Halloween. It is time to get out of here. Yeah, it was Bismarck. Some damn thing in the Balkans. Happy Halloween, y'all. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Sad to say, nothing rolled in the way of closing out October. So we'll just take it where it stands. We'll begin November tomorrow in a hole, but we'll begin November, and that's the important part. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Well, crmw.net will take you there. Go learn, become a part of the solution, and always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next.